You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
The best of Flashpoints for the week of March 15th, 2019. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, legendary Emmy Award-winning filmmaker John Pilger responds to the jailing of Chelsea Manning. Also, Roots Action co-founder Norman Solomon says Joe Biden is worse than you might think when it comes to the Dems running for president. And later in the show, award-winning journalist Max Blumenthal on continuing U.S. attempts to destabilize the Venezuelan government. All this straight ahead on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We kick off today's show with an interview from Monday's program with legendary Emmy Award-winning filmmaker John Pilger, who responds to the jailing of Chelsea Manning.
Your initial response to this, I mean, I just quote Chelsea Manning, this is what she said before they locked her up again after serving 7 years, two of those years in solitary confinement. She said, in solidarity with many activists facing the odds, I will stand by my principles. Imagine that. I will exhaust every legal remedy available. My legal team continues to challenge the secrecy of these proceedings, and I am prepared to face the consequences of my refusal. Well, somebody who stands up for what they believe.
How exotic that statement is to me. Who is somebody saying publicly that they're prepared to go to prison in order to stand by their principles? It's really thrilling in one sense to hear Chelsea Manning say that, but of course there are the great dangers for her personally. She needs particular care in prison, and the injustice of her being sent to prison is especially telling. It seems in the United States these days that any injustice is okay. This injustice comes via an archaic relic of, well, let's go right back, of the 12th century. That's when the first grand jury was implemented by King Henry II in England, and he used it for enforcing. He called it the King's Peace. It persisted in common law jurisdictions throughout the world, but was abandoned in all of them as something that was out of date, certainly not a respectable part of a modern justice system. It was abandoned in Britain in 1948, the only two countries that kept it is the United States and Liberia. And what is worse, I mean, people, they hear the word jury, so they think that, well, these jurors can be examined and there are various prejudices and biases teased out, and the proper fair-minded group of fellow citizens can be assembled. It's nothing like that at all. There's 16 to 23 people. And when the government in the United States wants to prosecute politically, and I emphasize that politically, it uses a grand jury in the Eastern District of Virginia. And the Eastern District of Virginia, as you all know, is a kind of a dormitory town for the national security establishment of the United States. The CIA, the NSA, the Pentagon, whatever, you name it, they're all there. They're all living side by side in suburban bliss. So there are various relatives and associates and so on. and those who know them will make up these grand juries, which have these star chamber, powers. For one thing, you give up your right to silence, the very basis of justice, your right to silence. And for this judge to jail Chelsea Manning for contempt, it's a system that is jailing him that is contemptible. And I think that's very important to understand that, because it's abusing the law in order to make
to catch people for political reasons. The whole problem with this, Dennis, is that they can't really, the government and those they're employing in the Eastern District of Virginia and the Department of Justice cannot really concoct a satisfactory charge against Julian Assange. Espionage is difficult for them because you have to prove deliberate intent. And so once it goes into a courtroom, it is certain to fail. So they've tried to concoct other charges. Of course, Julian Assange has committed no crime. He's done no more than the New York Times did and many other newspapers in the United States and around the world and published the leaks. And as for Chelsea Manning, she was very open about what she'd done. She was, in the literal sense of it, a conscientious objector. She was affronted by what she saw as an intelligence officer in Iraq, and she exposed the practices, particularly the collateral murder video. What they tried to do was pin a direct connection in her trial, a direct connection between her and Julian Assange. And they couldn't, they failed. They couldn't do it. Yes, she leaked it through WikiLeaks, but WikiLeaks has an encryption system that allows people to anonymously leak material so that on the WikiLeaks end, they don't know who it is. During all those months of trial, they were unable. In fact, they admitted they had a special inquiry headed by a general, I forget his name, to try and establish a direct link between Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning, so there was a conspiracy. They couldn't do it. So all they're doing is asking them, is interrogating Chelsea Manning all over again. But this time, what is so unfair, deeply unfair about this, apart from the fact they're incarcerating this person once again, a person who suffered cruel and inhuman punishment, according to UN Rapporteur on Torture. What they're doing is relying on one's normal flawed memory after a while, you know, so that they can try and trip her up. But she said everything. She's answered all the questions. I think it's so wonderful to hear, I have to say, Chelsea Manning's resolve that she is prepared to be imprisoned again in order to stand by her principles.
It is an extraordinary thing. It's an inspiration. Of course, I fear for her, but the decision to go forward the way she did really does set an example of a way to live, a consistent way to live. And in this time when truth itself has become a radical act, you know, left on the side of the road, this is an amazing moment in history. It is interesting that she was jailed again on International Women's Day. And, you know, this is somebody essentially who became a woman in solitary confinement. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I was thinking of that irony, and that brought to mind a question. And it's a question many so-called activists in the United States and perhaps elsewhere have to ask themselves. Where are they on Chelsea Manning? Why were there only 10 people outside courthouse? Where is Amnesty International? Where are the women's groups? Where are the LGBT groups? Where are the pride people? Why aren't they massing in support of Chelsea Manning? This is, instead, I see Chelsea Manning, the story, relegated in a sort of, oh, well, that's almost inevitable that this is going to happen. But this, as you've described it, is the most significant act of principle, an inspiration to all decent people, to Democrats, to people who believe in justice. So where are the groups who have been very loud in their condemnation, rightly, of Donald Trump? Where are they? Why are we not hearing from them? They should be in the streets.
You're listening to Flashpoints again. We are speaking with veteran filmmaker John Pilger. We're talking about, once again, the jailing of Chelsea Manning for refusing to give secret testimony to the grand jury, which is attempting to carry forth on threats of indictment, of trying to arrest Julian Assange. Now, there's a special place in this context for the corporate journalists, because it's not, I wish I could believe it was just pure ignorance. They don't understand the way in which WikiLeaks works, and or they're maybe they're frightened of telling the truth. After all, they're journalists and they're getting paid a lot of money. It seems to me that these journalists believe that Chelsea Manning should be in jail, and that Julian Assange isn't a publisher. They don't and that he should be tried for treason, because after all, these journalists are patriots. They're not reporters.
Well, I think just standing back from that question a little, Dennis, I think we can go on and beat our heads on the media brick wall and asking these questions of the media. The media is part of an oppressive system in various forms, and various forms of oppression. It is an extension of the established order. And these days, it is without something it used to have, and that is spaces, limited spaces, but spaces for free and fair comment. Right across the corporate media, these spaces have evaporated. So they are part of a system. They have shown this in a most grotesque way by the persecution of Julian Assange, the slandering of him, the distortion of the facts about his case. And it was also demonstrated during the trial of the court martial, rather, of Chelsea Manning. They're often empty seats. at that court-martial. Sometimes there might be one agency person. Some days there'd be none. There were a couple of people who didn't belong to the misnamed mainstream media who were there every day making a record, a very important record, of what went on. So it wasn't considered important enough. It was largely ignored. And I just think, in one way, it is right, certainly right for us to protest, and I think our protest against the media should be more of a direct action now. Occupy their spaces, occupy their buildings, confront them. But I think asking our questions over and over again why they do this is doesn't really lead us anywhere, because I think we know now. They are part of it. I think we have to ask ourselves, people, that is the majority of people, actually, of people who preserve human decency outside oppressive governments and outside oppressive media. We have to ask ourselves what we're doing about it, and that's why I pose the question. I think the word used in the United States is resistance. That's a pretty generous self-description, but let's say it is a resistance. Where is it? This is the most. The Chelsea Manning Julian Assange case goes to the very heart of everything. It is about freedom. It's not just about freedom of expression. It is about justice. It is about the law, the use of law, the misuse of law. It is about right and wrong. If there is going to be any real debate, I think we have to confront it, and we have to do it on our terms, not through the hopeless cipher of a corporate media.
Well, let's come out the other side of this, John, and maybe we can conclude by talking about the significance, just so we keep it center stage, the significance. What kind of impact do you think the release of that video had? Do you think it impacted the length of the war, the way in which the U.S. continued to prosecute it, the understanding about the war that the U.S. was fighting in Iraq, or you can't even call it a war, but whatever? What was the impact of that?
I think there have been other shocking visual evidence of criminal action during war. Collateral damage had almost refined down this criminality. When you hear the gunners saying, shoot, nice, it had a really hideous theatrical quality about it. And it came at a time of social media, whereas previous evidence has come at a time when television was where people got their information. I'm thinking of some of the footage from Vietnam. So this, the impact of this was almost universal, enormous. And it forced people to really think about what a military, if they were Americans, their military does when it invades a country, what it does in a civilian situation. The homicidal aspect of militarism. My sense, having reported from Vietnam, that it was largely a homicidal period. And there's no question that sense of homicide, of just murdering people 360 degrees, shoot them, blow them up, free fire zones, and all the rest of it, That has been carried on to the post, into the post-Vietnam invasions, and very spectacularly in Iraq, as demonstrated by a collateral murder. It's the most significant piece of evidence. And undoubtedly, when Chelsea saw that and decided to leak it, she was aware of that. And in doing so, of course, she performed an extraordinary public service, as did WikiLeaks in disseminating it.
Wow. Well, I think that's where we're going to leave it, John Pilger. As always, a pleasure to talk with you, enlightening conversation. And it's a story that we're going to stay right on top of because, again, I'll repeat myself. This is, we now live at a time when truth itself has become a radical act, a revolutionary act. Somebody tells the truth. We're watching TV and somebody tells the truth and we're all in shock. Did they actually say that? But, John, we can count on you, and we appreciate it.
It would be good to stay with us until Chelsea Manning is free.
Absolutely.
I think freeing Chelsea Manning has now become a moral imperative.
Because it could go on. They could keep they could keep renewing the grand jury. They can keep her in again forever.
Yeah. And this judge who seemed to have leapt out of the Middle Ages, Judge Claude Hilton, I think his name is, said, she will stay imprisoned until she is purged.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I think Laurence Olivier would have rejected that as a bit of a hammy line.
Yeah.
But it's certainly as if it's come out of the past, out of some kind of biblical punitive thing. Even though, of course, the grand jury, if you're imprisoned by a grand jury, it's not meant to be, this is where it becomes bizarre. It's not meant to be punitive. You're only there, you're only, quote unquote, in prison, because you're not doing as you're told.
Right.
So I think it's worth keeping an eye, more than an eye.
We will do that
until Chelsea Manning is free.
Listening to the best of Flashpoints for the week of March 15th, 2019. My name is Mike Biggs. Up next, an interview from Tuesday's show with Roots Action co-founder Norman Solomon, who says Joe Biden is worse than you might think when it comes to the Dems running for president.
Let's begin with the sort of a sweeping overview. He is clearly not a friend to the working man. He loves corporations, and he has been known to defend billionaires.
Well, yes, in the news media, he is a friend generally to the working man and woman. We're told so often about how he appeals to the, quote, white working class, and he has an incredibly long and powerful record after 36 years in the Senate and then 8 as vice president. He's the most seasoned servant of corporate power that we could possibly have become the next president. And some folks listening may think, well, Joe Biden, he has some liberal aspects. He really has come through for Democrats. But when you actually look beyond the smile and the hail fellow, well-met sort of image, and he does smile well. Let's give credit where due, and he's not a total villain from a progressive standpoint, but overwhelmingly, he does serve corporate America. He has a record, a prodigious record, of helping the lending industry to gouge millions of college students, and really just about anybody with a credit card can, quote-unquote, thank Joe Biden for serving the credit card and banking industry to put them up against the wall in terms of their rights, not only bankruptcy, but just their rights overall if they are borrowing any money as a mortgage, as a credit card, whatever it is. And this article that I've just written out of my research shows that he has consistently helped corporate America against consumers and against workers.
And that article, by the way, is Here Comes Joe Biden, and it's worse than you thought. It's up on Common Dreams now, and we are talking about the career of Joe Biden. Well, he also made some news back in the day with the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings. He played the he was the hitman. I hope I'm not overstating it. That's what it felt like to me for Clarence Thomas. He took on Anita Hill.
Anita Hill has said recently she still does not forgive Joe Biden for his role chairing the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings where she testified about the sexual harassment from Clarence Thomas, now one of the most extreme right-wingers on the Supreme Court. And actually, because of his seniority and his ability to rise to the top of the Senate, Biden was able to chair not only the Senate Judiciary Committee, but also the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations. So he has his political and personal fingerprints all over the crime bill that was passed in 1994, a notorious bill which was part of Lock 'em Up. The prison industrial complex owes billions of dollars of profits to Joe Biden. There's now a video that has surfaced of Biden speaking on the Senate floor prior to passage of that landmark 94 crime bill, which is just excruciating to listen to. It's frankly racist, and you can hear how he appealed to the racism of the day and the code words of the mid-1990s in that speech. And frankly, I think it's one reason why he's going to have big trouble getting very far in this quest for the presidential nomination. It's pretty clear now he is going to run for president again.
And we cannot emphasize too much the implications. You talk about racism and the crime bill and the suffering that still reverberates to this day based on the kind of mandatory minimums and the kind of lack of fair prosecution of black and white people. And he has never recanted on that, not that I've seen.
No, he hasn't recanted. He said with his finger to the wind that he regrets certain aspects of the bill. And this is part of the zeitgeist because progressives are on the move. And it's clear that because of the grassroots progressive wave that has been associated with politicians like Bernie Sanders, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, as a result of the grassroots organizing for progressive principles that have been going on for decades, and the media that has, from the bottom up, changed the discourse. And, you know, I would credit Flashpoints among many media outlets that have been chipping away at the corporate mentality and the racism and the militarism. Short term, we get discouraged, maybe even longer term, but it has an aggregate water on the stone effect. And when you look at, in retrospect, what was accepted in terms of locking people up and throwing away the key, there is now a tremendous push from the bottom up in terms of power to say, we do not accept this anymore. And I think the militarization of the police is another aspect of this top-down, corporate profit, rapacious outlook that Joe Biden has been part of. And one of the things that, frankly, had slipped my mind, I'd forgotten about Biden's role, more important than any other Democrat in the Senate, of bringing about the U.S. invasion of Iraq in March of 2003. And when I went back and did the research, I found that, yes, it reminded me, and through the article I've been able to remind a lot of other folks, he presided over sham hearings, the most important hearings on Capitol Hill before the invasion of Iraq, were chaired through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee by Joe Biden. And he absolutely did not allow any skeptics to testify. They were all war hawks. They were all people who argued about whether it was tactically good timing to invade Iraq, and if so, how to invade Iraq, not whether to do so.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Norman Solomon. We're talking about Joe Biden. Is he the liberal that it is portrayed that he is in the corporate press? How would you compare Joe Biden, say, to Elizabeth Warren, to Bernie Sanders, to some of the other candidates in terms of, say, health care? Is he pro-single payer?
Oh, he's opposed to single payer. And while Elizabeth Warren eventually came out in favor of it, that's not where Joe Biden is at. He really is upholding in this upcoming presidential race the centrist corporate pole, the most, if you will, farthest right within the Democratic Party spectrum of positions. And people may think, well, I'm just one person. I'm sitting here in California or Oregon or New York or whatever. What difference will it make? This is one of the amazing things we've seen when we've had people like Rashida Tlaib elected to Congress from Detroit. We've had Ilhan Omar from Minnesota. We've had AOC from New York. It really matters what we do from the grassroots. We're shaking up the national discourse and the power relations. And that's true in these primaries coming up, where we've got people at the grassroots who can absolutely affect who's nominated. And I think in the case of Biden, he is really juxtaposing himself intentionally against especially Bernie Sanders, who essentially is neck and neck with him now, as the polling tells us in Iowa, the first state where there'll be votes cast in this nomination race. It's mind-blowing to me the way in which the news media in general give Biden a pass, and they don't talk very much about his corporate ties, his corporate enmeshed record. And Dennis, one thing that's striking to me is when we see articles about Bernie Sanders, who is a real foe of Wall Street, very often the mass media, the corporate media, will say, well, there's the age factor. We very rarely in the news media see any reference to an age factor for Joe Biden. And yet, Biden is only 14 months younger than Bernie Sanders, but Biden is putting out the line that corporate media is very comfortable with. A lot of political journalists, they really like Joe Biden. He's been around for a long time, and I do want to mention a quote from Biden when he was speaking last year to the Brookings Institution. He said, quote, "I don't think 500 billionaires are the reason we're in trouble. The folks at the top aren't bad guys," unquote. Well, there you have it. If you don't think people at the top are, quote, bad guys, then Joe Biden is your guy. If you realize that the rapacious billionaires like Jeff Bezos are bad guys in terms of the ecology and social justice on the planet, then you realize that Joe Biden is a danger to all of us.
We hear a lot, Norman, about the WikiLeaks in the context of collaborating with Russia in the release of documents, particularly the Clinton documents. We never hear the content of the Clinton documents or that story about the role that the Clinton machine played in crushing Bernie Sanders and all other candidates, but really focused. Where did Joe Biden come in on that one? Did he ever speak out against the attacks on Bernie Sanders or the way in which the Clinton machine had been weaponized to take on all candidates?
So to speak, Joe Biden is part of the Clinton machine, the Clinton wing of the party, that corporate sector that has been dominating the party. He's somebody who, of course, decided not to run for the nomination in 2016. He was a big supporter of Hillary Clinton. And not only that, he was really part of the apparatus and the political weight that supported the Democratic National Committee in its very unfair tilting with superdelegates and so forth against Bernie Sanders. I should add that that's one of Biden's big problems now. Because of activism from the group Our Revolution and the organization RootsAction.org that I'm part of and other groups, we raised hell in the last 2 years. It is time to take away the power of superdelegates, and we largely succeeded. There are no superdelegates with any power to affect the nomination in 2020 for the first ballot, and there hasn't been a second ballot since 1952. So, frankly, if superdelegates still had that leverage, Biden would already be way ahead. But because they don't, he isn't. One thing we should remember is that when Edward Snowden courageously stepped forward to expose the shredding of the Fourth Amendment by the Bush and then Obama administrations, Joe Biden said he's a traitor.
Well, before we let you go, we're about to say hello to John Pilger, who's going to be talking about Chelsea Manning and her courageous action to face jail again rather than contradict her own beliefs and testify before the grand jury. What do you think, just to change the subject, what do you think the significance of that action by Chelsea Manning, and do we know anything about where Joe Biden comes down in this kind of story?
It's a courageous step by Chelsea Manning. She has stood up with great jeopardy and now being imprisoned again. She has stood up for civil liberties. She has stood up against the draconian repression of grand juries. We owe her, again, a tremendous debt of gratitude. And like Edward Snowden, she has been willing and able to defend the most basic civil liberties in the Bill of Rights. Joe Biden is somebody who, as part of the Obama administration, supported the jailing of more whistleblowers than all other presidents combined in the history of the United States. And I should say that there are some good things that President Obama did. One was to support the Iran nuclear deal that has now been destroyed by the Trump administration. The other is that in the 11th hour of his presidency, he freed Chelsea Manning from prison. And that, I think, is something that should have retained its effect for the rest of her life. Instead, now she's back in prison. I should say we have a petition with almost 10,000 signers already at rootsaction.org to free Chelsea Manning. And really, she's in there for us. We should be out here for her.
Tonight, my love will turn to life. Tonight, my love.
You're listening to the Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Finally, we close the show with an interview from Wednesday's program with award-winning journalist Max Blumenthal on the continuing U.S. attempts to destabilize the Venezuelan government.
Talk about the memo. So to lay this out, what did you know, what did you learn from this September 10th memo, and what does it have to do with the last couple of days in Venezuela?
I'd written about this memo before in a piece that I did with Dan Cohen, an investigation into the making of Juan Guaido, which you can find at the Gray Zone. And what we did was he looked into the soft power organization that trained Guaido and the founders of the Popular Will Party that he represents, which is one of the most radical parties in Venezuela connected to street violence and sort of a non-negotiation posture that has driven the country into chaos. And, you know, ever since 2005, but mainly starting in 2007, Guaido and his group of sort of youth activists were trained and cultivated by a Belgrade-based organization called Canvas that has been funded by the U.S. and apparently even enjoyed direct CIA financing. It was founded by Sergei Popovich, who has essentially laid out a series of blueprints for the Venezuelan opposition starting in 2007, but really culminating in 2010, about how they can exploit the kind of social, various social crises in Venezuela in order to topple then President Hugo Chavez and to basically end Chavismo, the sort of socialist Bolivarian revolution. And there was one document in particular, which is the most comprehensive document in 2010, which was revealed on WikiLeaks through a hack or a leak of the Stratfor group, which is sort of known as the private CIA, which was in communication with Canvas about the Venezuelan opposition and how they can weaponize it to take down Chavismo. And in this document, Sergei Popovich predicts that there will be a massive decrease in water levels around the Guri Dam, which is where the Simón Bolívar hydroelectric plant in Venezuela is located, which provides 80% of the country's electricity, and that there will be outages around 70% of the country, and that this would produce what he called a watershed event that will be able to be exploited by the opposition. And he called it an event that no opposition group could produce on its own. And he basically urged the opposition to prepare for massive electrical outages. Now, we know there have been blackouts in Venezuela over the years. Going back to 2008, there was a really big one. But this is the biggest blackout we've ever seen in Venezuela. And it wasn't just one still unexplained blackout that focused at the Guri Dam, at the Simón Bolívar plant. There have been explosions at substations around the country subsequent to this electrical outage. And the electrical outage occurred just a few days after Juan Guaido returned from Colombia as a failure, after having failed to ram the humanitarian aid as a Trojan horse across the Venezuelan border, a failure who had failed to control any institutions of government and was basically riding around on the back of a motorcycle aimlessly, needing some kind of success. This outage occurred exactly 5 hours after Marco Rubio, chairing Senate Foreign Relations Committee's panel, had called for widespread unrest in Venezuela and had said that Venezuela is about to enter a period of suffering unlike any nation in modern history. And exactly 5 hours later, Marco Rubio excitedly takes to Twitter to announce that power is out in 21 of 23 states in Venezuela. The Simón Bolívar hydroelectric plant had experienced a massive collapse. And he said that the backup generators weren't working, which is something that local authorities did not know at the time. And so it seems fairly obvious to me what happened, although we don't have evidence of sabotage. It seems just at least very fishy. But even if it wasn't sabotage, this is something that the Venezuelan opposition and its U.S. patrons and their soft power trainers have been preparing to exploit for years. And this is part of a years-long project to create chaos and destabilize the state of Venezuela.
Say a little bit more about this group based in Belgrade, Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies. They're funded, they're in Belgrade, but they're funded by the U.S. What's the core? What's their modus operandi? What do they announce? What is their project?
Yeah, this group cut its teeth in 1998, actually the year that Hugo Chavez was elected in Venezuela as president, bringing down the Serbian president, Slobodan Milosevic, through a series of kind of guerrilla street theater tactics, operating as a small cell, according to the techniques advised by Gene Sharp, who is said to be the kind of Clausewitz of nonviolence and is celebrated in U.S. liberal circles, but was actually essentially a CIA asset who worked with a military intelligence colonel named Robert Helvey to use Gandhian tactics of nonviolence as a weapon against governments that the U.S. wanted to have toppled. And what Sharp did through Otpor was the most successful demonstration of his tactics, because Otpor did remain nonviolent throughout that time. Clear what happened in the Balkans since then, and it isn't a very pretty history. But, you know, turning outwards, Otpor turned into canvas and began exporting these tactics with the help of money from the National Endowment for Democracy, USAID, which is the aid arm of the State Department that funds regime change around the globe, and the Albert Einstein Institute of Gene Sharp, which is also funded by the U.S. government. And so they began training activists in not only in Venezuela, but in Zimbabwe, where the U.S. has long sought, along with the U.K., to bring down Mugabe and his ZANU-PF party, in Russia, where the U.S. sought to prevent the rise of someone like Putin, in China, all sorts of places around the globe, even in South Korea, prepare the groundwork for regime change in North Korea, Nicaragua against the Sandinistas, pretty much anywhere that's been on the target board of regime change. Canvas has been training youth activists and getting lots of U.S. funding to do so. They started work in 2005 hosting Venezuelan student leaders in Belgrade, and that became what was known as Generation 2000, basically a group of really aggressive youth who knew the tactics of Gene Sharp, but were also willing to coordinate with violent gangs, Colombian paramilitaries. And 2007 really marked the year that the U.S. started to try to destabilize Venezuela. And it's brought us to this point with Juan Guaido, someone who is involved in workshops at least since 2010, as the leader of the Venezuelan opposition, essentially appointed by the U.S. and declaring himself interim president. But again, this is a years-long project that deserves much deeper investigation. And it's thanks to WikiLeaks, and I guess thanks to Julian Assange, who is now himself a target of the U.S., that we know about this, because they've hosted these documents in the Stratfor files that contain pretty much all of Canvas's plans for Venezuela going back about a decade.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Max Blumenthal. He's got a piece out, U.S. Regime Change Blueprint Proposed, Venezuelan Electricity Blackouts as Watershed Event. That is up at consortiumnews.com. Max writes from the Gray Zone and has been writing extensively about Venezuela. We're hearing sort of a lot of the reporting is now turning into, well, both sides are, you know, not in complete control. It's sort of an equal breakdown, but we've got this new emerging leader, this democratic leader, and he can make all the difference. Meanwhile, I understand the United States has now asked all its personnel to leave the country. Is that significant?
Well, the U.S. personnel was actually ejected by the Venezuelan foreign ministry. They're given 72 hours. And this is the product of an attempt by the Venezuelan government to eject them going back to January, when the U.S. essentially appointed Guaido and demanded regime change and initiated a coup. The U.S. diplomatic personnel refused to leave. And what the Venezuelan foreign ministry is saying is, you know, it's time for you to stop sabotaging us from within. And if you want dialogue, you can treat us as an equal partner. But Pompeo has framed this as diplomatic personnel being pulled out, which is an aspect of the psychological warfare the U.S. is waging on Venezuela, because it creates the perception that a bombing campaign could begin or something terrible. Elliot Abrams actually has said that while there's no plans for a military invasion, they need to keep hinting at it to essentially psychologically terrorize the Venezuelan military.
How do you see, how have you been able to assess the role of Elliot Abrams? Has he really been able to bring that imprint that he's got for doing the worst, for supporting all kinds of violence and sort of trying to impose U.S. policy at any means, any cost? Do we see his imprint yet, or what can we expect from him? How are you watching him?
Well, I'll make two points. First is that we heard the really candid, true side of Elliot Abrams in a call. There were two phone calls he had with Russian pranksters who were posing as the president of the Swiss Federation. And they got Elliot Abrams on the line and said, "We know where Maduro's secret bank accounts in Switzerland are." And Elliot Abrams was really like on the verge of orgasm when he heard this, and really revealed a lot of his strategy and his thinking, his line of thinking to these Russian pranksters. And one thing he said was that, yes, we don't have any plans for military invasion. We just like to say all options are on the table to frighten Venezuela's government. But what we're going to do is continue waging an economic and financial attack. And so Abrams is sort of presiding over a bunch of lower level figures who are investigating every aspect of the Venezuelan economy and attacking it because there's no political cost for it. The other point I want to make is that Elliot Abrams had been a sort of pariah in Washington, although he was influential in the Bush administration and its policy in Israel-Palestine, overseeing a coup attempt in a very covert fashion against the government of the Gaza Strip, which failed. I think, you know, we're witnessing Elliot Abrams, and this might kind of come as a shock to a lot of your listeners. We're witnessing Abrams rehabilitate his reputation in Washington. He's being seen in an increasingly favorable light within kind of beltway think tank and official circles, because there is a broad consensus within the Washington foreign policy elite in favor of regime change in Venezuela. And so far, Abrams has kind of handled it in a sort of cool and collected fashion. He's fluent in Spanish as well as French, and he's done a lot of press conferences in Spanish. And while he's a villain to us, and correctly so, because of his role in genocide-level atrocities in Central America, in Washington, he's increasingly being welcomed and is taking a more public role than at any time since the 1980s. And that's incredibly frightening. And it really shows you how disconnected elite foreign policy circles are in Washington from the general public. We're going to have a large march in Washington on March 16th, this Saturday. The weather may not be great, but we're expecting thousands. And I think, you know, even on an issue like Venezuela, where the U.S. isn't invading, I think that'll be a rebuke to the fake elite bipartisan consensus that prevails in Washington for regime change.
Well, they do have, the Trump administration does have the corporate press on this one as well.
Totally.
Could you talk about, I mean, it is extraordinary. You've got this sort of the liberal MSNBC finding a place where they can meet with Trump and agree with Trump.
Absolutely. Absolutely. CNN and MSNBC, I mean, you expect it from Fox. And Trish Regan on Fox actually did an interview with Juan Guaido in Spanish where she welcomed him, calling for essentially a U.S. invasion. That's what Guaido is out there doing. He's calling for the invocation of Article 187 from the Venezuelan Constitution, which allows foreign military assistance. But meanwhile, MSNBC and CNN are running a straightforward information war. No one is allowed on these networks who opposes regime change or the policy of sanctioning Venezuela's economy to death. On the February 23rd, action that the U.S. waged, which was just a straightforward provocation using aid as a Trojan horse. CNN and MSNBC presented these extremely violent elements on the Colombian side who wound up actually torching U.S. aid trucks and blaming it on Maduro. They presented them as activists and protesters and said they were just simply angry that the aid couldn't get through. These are violent right-wing elements that are being weaponized by Colombian security forces and paramilitaries against Venezuela. And it was just shocking. CNN even embedded a reporter among them in a mask and presented them as these kind of revolutionary heroes. So it's one of the most, you know, naked demonstrations of U.S. media and the kind of nexus that it has with national security state in attempting to sell this regime change plot. And it is very similar to what the U.S. media did in Syria. It's also notable to watch CNN host Tulsi Gabbard, who is the only presidential candidate forcefully speaking out against regime change in Venezuela and the coup being nakedly waged by the Trump administration, hosting her for a town hall, setting her up with this phony question, is Assad a war criminal? And then going on the warpath against her the following day. Essentially, CNN is campaigning against Tulsi Gabbard and trying to dictate the terms of the presidential debate. And that has a lot to do, I think, with the nexus between the national security state and mainstream media, corporate media. Now, look at the number of contributors on MSNBC and CNN who are former CIA officials, Michael Hayden, James Clapper, James Comey, John Brennan. CNN even has the former chief of staff for the CIA. MSNBC is the former chief of staff for the CIA under Obama. Jeremy Bash is a contributor who's also clearly shaping a lot of the content. So, I mean, you could refer to CNN as the CIA news network or the central neocon narrator, because that's the role it's playing in Venezuela and the presidential race.
And yeah, Jeremy Bash is just he is on all the time, every show.
Yes.
He's the core.
It's basically having a CIA agent as a contributor. Jeremy Bash is the ex-husband of Dana Bash, who hosted Tulsi Gabbard for the town hall. And, you know, so the nexus is very personal between the CIA and CNN.
Well, we're going to leave it right there, but very enlightening, Max Blumenthal. Max Blumenthal is an award-winning journalist and the author of books including the best-selling Republican Gomorrah, Goliath, The 51-Day War, and The Management of Savagery, which will be published in March by Verso. Max, thanks for joining us. By the way, if people want to sort of keep track with your work on a daily basis, what's the best way?
TheGrayZone.com. I'm Max Blumenthal on Twitter. And you can advance order my book, The Management of Savagery, which contains a lot of relevant info and insights into, you know, four decades of regime change policy by the U.S. and how it's torn at the political and social fabric of our societies. It's online at Amazon, Powell's, Verso, The Management of Savagery.
Beautiful. Thank you for joining us, Max. Thanks for taking the time out.
Thanks so much, Dennis.
Take care now. Be careful.
And that does it for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Kevin Pina and Miguel Gavilan Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. We return with part two of Michael Parenti's fine speech in Springfield, Illinois, of October 16, 2015. It's called Capitalism Versus Reality. It's a fascinating and brilliant talk. Enjoy.
The capitalist state, and that's what we live under. We live under a government that works in a capitalist system. The capitalist state has two core functions. The first is to maintain and advance capital accumulation. That is, the companies, the corporations have to keep making their money, and that process of them accumulating wealth has to be protected. And it's being protected very well. In the last 10 years, all the new wealth that has been produced, all of it went to the top 1%, 1 or 2%. And when I talk about capitalism and such, I'm talking about the giant corporations. I'm not talking about mom and pop small businesses, because all I can say is I'm not talking about them. Lenin was right. He said 10 million small businesses count for nothing. A few giant cartels count for everything. A cartel is like the oil cartel, which would be made up of Exxon and Mobil, and they collude together and they divvy out the market and they play with the prices and the like. Small business, I call it the squirrels dancing among the elephants. And you know what happens to squirrels would dance among elephants. Have you ever seen it? No, you haven't, but they tend to get smashed and squashed. I've been accused of being soft on small businesses, and that's true, I am. As individuals, capitalism does not usually bring out the best in us. We face too many ugly necessities created by the competitive dog-eat-dog system. Unfortunately, capitalism best rewards the worst part of us: ruthless, competitive, conniving, opportunistic, exploitative, acquisitive drives. Private enterprise, as it's sometimes called, gives little reward and often much punishment, or at least much handicap, to honesty, compassion, many forms of hard work, cooperative and collective effort, love of justice and fair play, and a concern for those most in need. There was a great labor union leader who later became a noted socialist leader, American, named Eugene Victor Debs from Indiana. And Debs remarked with bitter irony that to the extent that that life in an advanced capitalist state is made bearable or decent, barely decent, it's because of the humanizing effects of democratic struggle and labor struggle. And Debs started figuring all this out while he was in jail. He was leading the railroad strike and all that, and he got beaten up and thrown in jail. I've been beaten up by police and thrown in jail. And let me tell you, when you get slammed in the jail and slammed against the bars and thrown in there and they lock it up, you have time to think, you know. You really sort of sit there and you say, what is going on? What is this all about? Wait a minute. Where's the stars and stripes and all that stuff? Nobody's singing. And Debs was sitting there, and he's saying, this is crazy. Why are the cops on the side of the big bosses? Why aren't the cops out there on the side of the workers? We are the people of society. We're the people who do all those jobs. And then he began to realize that the state is not neutral. That state is not neutral. If there's a disruption and this and that, the state comes out, and they start serving the powers that be. But Debs was making this other point, which I thought was very interesting, that the more successful we are, we pull down certain, you know, increases and betterment in wages and this or that and this and that. We make life a little bearable, more bearable. We cut our 14-hour day to a 13-hour day. That's a little bit better, you know. Whatever, we try to make this society more human. we are legitimating it. And what we really should be doing is telling the people, look, this isn't for us at all. This is a society that's heartless and inhumane, and we're making it somewhat a little more humane. We create little patches of community and democratic distribution in which we try to live. Is capitalism not a successful economic system? It has success. It is the envy of the world, what we have in America. Well, it really isn't. It depends on your position in the social order. Let's start with capitalist leaders. Nancy Pelosi, Congresswoman, Democratic Party, Speaker of the House, in 2008, at the end of George W. Bush's term, she says, Bush is a complete failure on every policy area. I would argue Bush was a smashing success in almost every policy area. Bush himself didn't hold back in his personal praise. He said, and I think he was right, absolutely right, he said he accomplished everything he could do within the strictures of the presidential office, except two things. He failed to undo Social Security. That means pensions, dependency, and disability. That's what Social Security covers. If something bad happens to you, you will not be left to just lie in the street. You do get some support. It's a socialist program. That's socialism at work. And they are dedicated, the conservatives are dedicated to eliminating it every chance they can get, or nibble away at it, or break it down, minimize it. Bush also pointed out that he brought in, well, no, he doesn't point it out. I'm pointing it out what Bush did. I'm sorry. Bush had provided massive increases in the military budget, a military budget that went from $250 billion to something like $526 billion. Today, under Obama, it's closer to $1 trillion a year. $1 trillion a year. Some of that money comes from the Energy Department. Some of it comes from other things. Some of it comes from these other wars that are then slapped onto this budget as an extra budget. Massive shifts in tax burden to the working class and middle classes. Cutbacks and defunding and deregulation of human services, including public education and environmental protections. Massive debt, which helps to defund government. Kill these programs, not because they don't work, but because they do. That's why they want to get rid of Social Security, not because it doesn't work, but because it does. It's been about the best check on poverty, elderly poverty, that we've had. Capitalism is less successful in the more prosperous countries. That is, a country that is prosperous, like Finland, Norway, Denmark, Sweden. These are the social democracies. After World War II, they faced the Red Army along the Elbe River. They faced all of Eastern Europe was now communist. All these communist countries were now providing Social Security, old age pensions, supports, guaranteed right to a job to every worker, free medical care to every worker. This was going on in the communist countries. Subsidized rent and housing. No worker could spend more than, I think it was 15% of his salary on rent. So you were guaranteed, you didn't have to put all your money on your housing. These kind of things were very embarrassing. And after World War II, you had a very strong social democratic parties, including some communists, voting and bringing in governments that did these generous human services for all, more equitable tax system, consumer and worker protections, excellent utility and transportation services, and then all the things I just mentioned about the other social democracies. But social democracies are recent, and they're never really secure. Look what's happened in the United Kingdom. It's rolling back now since Tony Blair. They've been undermining it and cutting it back, and the Brits are paying more and more and getting less and less for it. And there are cutbacks all through Western Europe because there's no more Eastern Europe. There's no more communism. The Red Army's gone. The big communist parties in France and Italy are pretty much gone. So the guys at the top no longer have to make frightened concessions to the mass of the people. In contrast to the social democracies of Western Europe, I mean, they're still pretty good. They're better than what we've got. I mean, if you were ill, you're much luckier to be ill in Finland than in the United States. Capitalism is a more complete success in countries like Indonesia, Nigeria, Colombia, El Salvador, places like that. That's where, let's take Indonesia. And by successful, I mean more successful in serving that 1% at the very top. They don't have to kick back for all these regulations and all these human services and such. In Indonesia, there's no customer service or warranties on commodities. Drinking water is privatized and unclean. You have to buy drinking water, and you got to hope it's clean. No public health services, no environmental protections, chaotic auto traffic, regular bus plunges, buses going off because roads are so poorly graded and unfixed, rampant crime, terrible poverty. But the rich, the rich in Indonesia, they live so well. They live in such lush luxury. They have small armies of servants who serve them. And the servants are de facto slaves. And if the servant doesn't want to serve and wants a day off or wants that, he or she can be kicked out. And there'll be five other people waiting at the gate to come in and serve. And so that's the kind of world that the capitalists want, a world of billionaires who can call their shots and the rest of us lining up with bowed head. Capitalism makes a claim not only to democracy, but to prosperity. Not true. The goal is private wealth for the few and public poverty for the many. And that's what I was saying about Indonesia and the like. The poorer and hungrier you are, the harder you will work for less and less. And the more surplus value I, the boss, can extract from you. Free enterprise and competition are widely celebrated as part of the dynamic and abundance of capitalism. In fact, the corporate enterprise system almost always is in a state of crisis. Even in the USA, abnormality is normality. Recessions, 1780s, terrible recessions, terrible fights about rent, land rents and taxes and such. It led to Shays' Rebellion, and Shays' Rebellion led to the Constitutional Convention. They hurried together to whip together a stronger government to stop this kind of thing. 1805, panic. 1820s, recessions. 1850, market crashes. 1873, a whole decade of depression. Another whole decade, 1890s. Teddy Roosevelt in 1896 saying, this country needs a war, any war. And he got it in 1898, which was what? The Spanish-American War. 1910, 1920s. The 1920s were a recession time. I never learned that. We always learned the 1920s were what? The jazz age, right? The roaring 20s, they were called. Charleston. With very little inducement from you, I can do the Charleston, right? But I won't. This went on through the whole 1920s. You know where the recession was in the 1920s? It was mostly in rural areas, which is probably why it could go undetected. But in the rural areas, it was very hard on people, both black and white. Then at the end of that decade, in October 1929, came the great crash of the stock market and the depression came. That depression lasted from 1929 to 1941. It ended in 41-42 because the U.S. was now in a major global war against Japan and Germany. 1941, this is where you got to take a look more closely, because this explains the great American prosperity, and it did come around that time. I remember my uncle Nick and my dad and my uncle Joe all talking and moaning about how the war is going to be over fairly soon. And we're going to be hit with a terrible depression again. I said, why? I always used to hear about this thing called the depression. You're surprised to know I was even alive then. I look so young, don't I? You thought I was like, like 35 or 40, I know. Okay, yeah, right. They understood that 9 million young American men and some tens of thousands of women are going to come back out of uniform and come back into the economy. There's going to be no jobs. Where are all the jobs going to be? See, there were, the Depression ended in 1941 because the U.S. was ready to really spend. They spent deficit spending. They spent enormous amounts of money to do in war what they could would never do in peace, which was to build all these planes and tanks and whatever else. But when the war was over, these 9 million of these people who came back entered the GI Bill of Rights, GI Bill. The GI Bill was a tremendous program. It brought to every veteran from the war could go back to school, and he would get a full stipend and a full payment of his tuition fees also, a scholarship. Or others could start small businesses, and others could do all sorts of other kinds of things. It turned out to be one of the most economically terrific things. GI veterans who hadn't finished high school were now becoming accountants or going on into other professions. It actually enriched the whole economy terrifically. Another thing that happened was all during the war, people like my Uncle Nick, who used to make $50 a week as a garage mechanic, he quit being that during the war, and he went to work in a war factory, and making planes and this and that. So you had people now doing all this kind of work, and coming away with lots of money. The trouble is they had nothing to buy. I remember that too during the war. Everything was rationed. So you had all this money now, but you couldn't buy. The factories were no longer making electric toasters or refrigerators or cars or anything like that, or houses. The factories were making planes and tanks, and you couldn't buy a tank, and you didn't have much use for a tank anywhere. So you had this immense backlog of buying power, and that's really one of the problems of recessions is, of course, you haven't paid your workers enough money to buy back the goods and services that they're producing, and that's how why you have a recession. So all of that was changing, the GI Bill and then this. And from 1947 to, I would say, 1979, 1981, during the last 2 years of Carter, where he started selling out, and the introduction of Ronald Reagan coming in, up until that time, that's the immense prosperity you got, building of suburbia, building of highways, the kind we... Everything you see and take for granted now, freeways, highways, all those things, they didn't exist back when I was graduating from school. When we heard that the Pulaski Highway in Jersey, did you hear about it? You can go 60 miles an hour. Wow, 60 miles an hour. Yeah, a mile a minute. Well, that's only 60 miles an hour. What's so fast about that? We learned later on as more and more cars came out and this and that. So there was this kind of backlog of consumer hunger. A consumer hunger that's backed by money, by ability to buy for it. That became the basis of the great prosperity. A prosperity which is now eluding us, a prosperity which is declining and declining. You hear reports about 20,000 more new jobs, people, but they don't tell you about the quality of the jobs, the paying of the jobs, the durability of it. As part of the myth of prosperity, the Horatio Alger myth, as you know it, the view that every generation is more prosperous than the previous one, it just isn't so. In the last 20 years, all the new wealth created went to the top 2 or 3% in the last 20 years. The rest of us have worked harder and stayed much in the same place. And if you're working harder and harder to stay in the same place, you're not staying in the same place. Our national debt is greater and greater. It's up to, what, $17 trillion now? We, the taxpayers, owe that. The national debt belongs to us. Karl Marx made that point in Kapital, Volume 1, where he said, of all the things in society, the one thing that belongs to the people is the national debt. They own it. They'll be taxed. They have to pay it. And they pay it to those who own all those U.S. bonds, those national bonds and such, which are the rich. This recession that we've been living in now, the 2008-09 one, is still going on. at 2015. These recessions, it's like all recessions, it has certain advantages, not for us, but for the 1%, the people at the very top. It wipes out weaker competitors. It allows mergers at more affordable costs, concentrations. Marx called that one capitalist. The phrase was, one capitalist will kill many capitalists. Back in 1910, there must have been 20 or 30 auto factories, auto businesses arising. About 13 of them provided electric cars, believe it or not. The electric cars got wiped out, though. And the others came in. By the great prosperity, we're talking now no longer about businesses, we're talking about giant corporations. You had only three auto companies, right? Ford, Chrysler, who was the third one? General Motors, the biggest, I forgot it. Yeah, General Motors, right, thank you. And that's the way it is with the oil companies. That's the way it was with the meat packing companies. There must have been about 200 meat packing companies. To play safe, I'll say by World War I or by 1920, that had broken down to Armour and Swift and one or two others, about four or five of them. I'm thinking of the book, The Triumph of Conservatism. And it was about that turn of the century where the cartels and these few big companies took over. And it happens all the time. I think it happened with computers, didn't it? I mean, there were all sorts of little companies starting up, people's garages and this and that. And then it gets back down to, what, three or four companies, giant companies with billions of dollars. That doesn't mean that these big companies don't take money from the government. They do. They don't want you to take money from the government. They don't want you to get food stamps. They don't want you to get rent subsidies. But they take money. They take billions every year. They take over land, for instance. What the Pentagon does with McDonnell Douglas, right? Well, they'll give him the land. They'll give them the materials. They can build the factory, and then they can produce whatever new jet or new rocket or new instrument of death is needed. And this is all done compliments of the taxpayers. The goal of giant global capitalism is the third worldization, not only of the U.S. economy, but of the entire world. I've written books on that. The U.S. global military machine undermines any country, any government, any leader that uses the land, labor, capital, and natural resources for the development of their own country. So we have not only public suppression and impoverishment at home, but we got it around the entire globe, with wars two, three, four at a time, military bases, hundreds of them around the world. The empire feeds off the republic, the face of imperialism, I called it. $1 trillion a year is spent from the Pentagon budget and related budgets, increasing the deficit into trillions upon trillions. I advocate socialism when it works and because it works. The post office, it works. They're trying to bust up the post office, and they're doing a good job of it now, the Republican Congress is. But it was a very decent kind of thing. It was the largest union workers, a group of union workers in any one, I think, any one enterprise. You could deliver, you still can, deliver for 47 cents. You can deliver a letter from your door to someone 3,000 miles away. For 45 cents, 47 cents, you can do that. Social Security, we've got, and I like that. I think it's fair, it's humane, it's decent. Medicare, when it works, against a prohibitive, profit-driven medical and insurance corporations. Public health care for everyone and everything. Housing, transportation, as in France, for instance, or Japan, where they've got these tremendous super monorail trains that go that cannot be derailed. I like that. Public utilities, I find that's better than private utilities. I live in California, and I got PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric. They talk about private competition, and we're efficient, and we give you. Well, they don't do that at all. They charge us the highest rates in America. If you had a public utility, that public utility doesn't spend millions of dollars on advertising. It doesn't spend millions of dollars on its CEO bosses having to be paid 30, 40, 50 million a year. The public utilities are much, much safer. PG&E got a $45 million handout from the state of California to start checking up on the gas leaks in his whole system of gas, and it didn't do it. It even got, in San Bruno, it got complaints from people who were smelling gas, and it didn't do it. It used that money to wage a proposition campaign, to have a proposition which said that only private utilities can function in California, no public utilities. And they had millions of dollars to spend, and the miracle was that they lost. The people voted against that. The people are interested in socialism, as long as you don't call it socialism and you just give them the benefits and the functions of it. And so what PG&E did was they spent all that money on that campaign. They lost the campaign, but in San Bruno there was an explosion, a gas leak. And 8 people were killed and 40 homes were blasted. I saw photographs of it. I treated it in my book, Profit Pathology, a little bit of a chapter on that. And public education is being destroyed, as we see before our own eyes, where students are having to pay for education when they were supposed to get one that was free with minimal costs. Professorships are getting wiped out, and adjuncts are being used. An adjunct is a teacher who gets paid only by a course, one course here, one there, and all that. Very poorly paid, hard to survive. And this is what's happening. And the money, it goes to the big administrators and goes to the presidents of the universities and the regents and the like. So you turn the university into something that resembles a private corporation. We hear that we must fix the system. Unfair tax distribution, insufficient health care goes on, low wages, wage theft, all sorts of inequities. But no, some of us argue, the system is fixed. It's rigged already. It is the way they want it to work. As far as they're concerned, these last 10 years haven't been so bad. I've had students say, one time when I was teaching at SUNY, State University of New York in Albany, the students said, but what socialism does? How would it work? It's a dream, isn't it? A dream in theory and a nightmare in practice. That's a phrase I myself coined just to sum it up for their anxieties. You think it's a dream in theory and a nightmare in practice. My students at SUNY, they would say, "How would it work?" And I would say, "Well, you're sitting in it right now." You are too, you know, or less and less, of course, as they privatize it. Better than private colleges on Long Island and more affordable before they raise tuition horribly and privatize private education. And so I'm for that. I'm for real public education. I'm for real public utilities, for public housing that's affordable and made in a humane fashion, public transportation, public hospitals. So I advocate socialism because it works when it works. Small business, small services, maybe they could also work and have a place there. End the power of these giant corporations. Bring back real democracy and real prosperity. Thank you for your kind attention, folks.
Michael Parenti, concluding his fine talk, Capitalism versus Reality, very lightly edited by yours truly. Thank you for listening to New World Notes. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegit to my non-carborundum, and please come back again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. On today's show, you'll hear the second and final part of an interview with three esteemed members of the 9/11 Truth Movement to discuss the grand jury investigation into the collapses of the three World Trade Centers in New York City on 9/11, which is now before the federal court in New York City. It's an honor to introduce these three esteemed guests. First, we have Richard Gage, who was a San Francisco Bay Area architect of 30 years, a member of the American Institute of Architects, and the founder and president of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Then we have Barbara Honegger. Barbara Honegger is a leading researcher, author, and public speaker on September 11th. She is a board member and grand jury petition drafting committee member for the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 inquiry that filed a demand for a special federal criminal grand jury on the World Trade Center attacks in April of 2018 with the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York. Barbara Honegger served as White House policy analyst and Department of Justice official in the Reagan administration, and for over a decade was the senior military affairs journalist at the Naval Postgraduate School of the Department of Defense. And our third esteemed guest is David Weissminkel. He's been a licensed attorney in New Jersey since 1989 and a practicing criminal defense attorney for over a decade. He is presently the president and a board member of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. He's a retired police officer of 23 years and a United States Army veteran who was stationed in Germany where he worked with Pershing nuclear missiles in a top secret area. In 2009, Weissminkel ran as an independent against Chris Christie for governor. He was the only candidate who spoke about the need for a new 9/11 investigation. So as you can see, my guests today are three highly educated, highly experienced individuals who have dedicated a great deal of their time, energy, and expertise to exposing the truth about what happened on 9/11-2001. So let's begin today where we left off with this interview from last week. Richard, you've already talked about a lot of the evidence, but maybe you could give us some more examples of this evidence that really, I mean, it's irrefutable evidence against the official story of 9/11.
Heading back to Building 7, here's this 47-story skyscraper that wasn't hit by an airplane, and yet it drops like a rock. What does that actually mean? It's falling at free fall acceleration. That means not one of those 80 columns is providing any resistance to its fall. That means they must have been removed. The only way to do that is by explosive-controlled demolition, i.e. explosives or incendiaries, which destroy those steel columns. So that is, in and of itself, direct evidence of explosive destruction that any expert will testify to. Beyond that, we have all kinds of fascinating information. For instance, in order for a building to fall that fast, it means that 400 structural steel connections are failing every second. And this is due to isolated pockets of fire scattered across many floors, relatively small fires, none of which have ever brought down a skyscraper in the history of skyscrapers ever before 9/11. Come on. But in addition to that, you have foreknowledge of this building's collapse. The firefighters are expecting it to come down. They were told it had damage and it's going to come down. So they're moved back several blocks. And then you have witnesses that are held back behind the yellow tape, if you will, like Kevin McPadden, who's listening to a radio held in the hands of a Red Cross worker, and he hears 3, 2, 1, and then he felt like a train was running underneath his feet. He talks about these explosions, very clearly explosions, before the building immediately then came down. So this is all fascinating evidence that's not included, of course, in the NIST report or the 9/11 Commission report. We also have illegal removal, destruction of evidence in a crime scene, as Dave alluded to. Just 2 weeks after 9/11, the steel from World Trade Center 7 at a rate of 400 truckloads per day was put on barges and shipped to China for recycling before forensic inspectors could get their hands on it. They only had a couple of beams that they took photo ops of measuring and so forth. And one of those was Abu Hazen Astani Azal, a UC Berkeley professor, who complained about the steel being shipped away to China. He says, this is a crime. And the photo that he has, he's documenting the corrosion of the steel, which is hot temperature corrosion, the melting of the beams, which he falsely attributes to being down in the pile and fires. Well, fires are put out in Building 7. They were put out when the building collapsed. It extinguished all the fires, and yet NASA overflight find 1,400-degree temperatures on the surface of that pile. That's more than twice as hot as those temperatures of those fires in that building ever were. So what are they measuring? They're measuring much, much hotter temperatures radiating from this molten iron down in the pile, of which so many first responders, structural engineers, and metal workers documented. So I can go on and on, but I'm just hogging all the time.
Wow, that's very valuable information. This is a question for Dave, and maybe Barbara also on this one, but what are some of the possible areas where the government, through the grand jury process, could continue the cover-up and not be genuine in their pursuit of justice?
You never know, I mean, because we're not inside that, and anything can happen. We would like to imagine that it's going to be presented and that people are going to be able to look at it, the grand jurors, and connect the dots and utilize the resources the U.S. attorney has as far as investigators. Now, one of the things we've done is we've asked them, we told them we would like to assist them and make presentations with them or, you know, on their behalf and call witnesses and stuff like that if we could bring witnesses in, like architects and engineers or people that are associated with them. But we would like to present the evidence to them, and we haven't received a response from them. Now, there's an action which we're prepared to do, we'd prefer not to do, it's called a mandamus action. And that would be a complaint in court, which would be against the Department of Justice, the U.S. attorney, and it would basically say to the judge, Your Honor, the U.S. attorney has a legal obligation to present the evidence that we've given to the grand jury, and they haven't done that. We are asking you to order them to do it, all right? So order them to do it. And if they didn't do it, they would be in contempt, and that would be pretty interesting what would happen. As far as how we're going to be on top of it, that's something that we'll have to feel it as it goes along. Hopefully we can make some more contact with them, and then we'll get an acknowledgement from them. We may even decide to actually try to get an acknowledgement directly from them. There are other things we can do besides the grand jury petition. There are other actions that could be done. And, you know, it could be done. Not to say it will, but it could be. So we didn't put all the eggs in this basket, so to speak, as far as this particular grand jury. This is just directed now. That was a very sophisticated crime on 9/11, and it encompassed a number of crime scenes. We mentioned the Building 7, and we mentioned the towers, the North and South Tower, Building 1 and 2. But we didn't talk about the Pentagon because this evidence isn't directed at what happened at the Pentagon, and we didn't talk about Shanksville, and that evidence is not directed at what happened in Pennsylvania. And there's other possible actions that could happen. So this is basically the first action by the Lawyers Committee in the courts, and we're feeling our way as we go. We've not been down this path here as an organization. I have personally had some contact as a criminal defense attorney with grand juries, but nothing like this. Yeah, we're asking them to investigate the worst crime in the history of our country, I would say. And we've given them the documents that they need to do it. They should have done it 16 or 17 years ago. We don't know how politics would play into it. This is a fluid context in which we are in right now, historically. And hopefully we've just caught the wave at the right time. That for whatever reason, they've acknowledged and told us that they're going to honor our request. They didn't have to do that. They've done it. That, to me, that's significant. That letter, that two-sentence letter that I read previously, it gives all these arguments credibility. It gives all that evidence credibility because the U.S. attorney is saying that he's going to present that. And again, we have to just feel it as we go. It's almost probably instinctive. It's not something that I can just tell you. There's not a procedure as far as us getting an acknowledgement, other than if they want to give us an acknowledgement. We'll do the best we can, though. And maybe Barbara has more insights to it and Richard than what I just said. But it's a new road for us, and we're counting on them to do what they're supposed to do. And if we have any hint that they're not, we're prepared to go into court to force them to do that. And we also have other actions we can do around these evidence and around this situation in New York.
Good to hear. And Barbara?
Yes, I would like to add to that. The first thing I'd like to add is that Dave Meiswinkle touched on it, but it is our intent that this is not the first grand jury that we are going to demand under the law is convened. We intend to do that for the other main sites, the Pentagon, Pennsylvania, for government cover-up, for the anthrax attacks, perhaps. There are many other areas that we can have also petitions to the grand jury in the future to demand that the convening of grand jury. Another point I want to make is what they have agreed to do under the cited statute that Dave read in the U.S. Attorney's letter to us of November 7th. It requires them not only to present all of the evidence in our petition and the 57 exhibits that are part of the petition to the grand jury, and everyone can read exactly what the grand jurors are going to see on our website, but it also requires them to convene the grand jury, and not just any grand jury, but a federal special criminal grand jury. This is a big deal. And it requires time to do. It requires going through the voter rolls and maybe also the DMV rolls. And what's important for people to understand also is that those 23 grand jurors, special criminal grand jurors, are going to be from the jurisdiction for which the World Trade Center Towers and World Trade Center 7 are part. So they are likely going to be a bunch of them from Manhattan. And these are people whose lives to this day are phenomenally impacted by the lie of who attacked the World Trade Center Towers and the World Trade Center 7 on 9/11. That's number one. Number two, though, very important, there was a reference by Dave to the political context. As it happens historically, while we are doing the recording for this show, Cheryl, I have been watching since 6:30 a.m. my time here in California, straight through, and it's going on tomorrow at least as well, the confirmation hearings for William Barr to the Attorney General of the United States. The Attorney General of the United States will have a tremendous influence and impact over what happened with the grand jury for the World Trade Center that we know is going to go forward. And also, people should know that for whatever reason, the Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, who approved we originally communicated with, who is head of the criminal division that apparently allowed our grand jury to go forward, she was just removed from her job. And a commercial, private sector, white-collar criminal defense attorney was placed in the position instead. So we are definitely David taking on Goliath. But as Dave Meiswinkle, the president of the Lawyers Committee, said, we are inside the castle. And we got inside before they drew up the drawbridge. So we will see what happens.
Excellent. Thank you. So is there a timeline or a time frame from when you got your letter on November 7th saying that they were going to take up this grand jury investigation? Do they have a timeline where they have to have the jurors in place or be starting the investigation?
Not that we know of. I think it has, in law, it's always what's reasonable.
Okay.
So if we have to do some action and we go into court, they'd have to show that what they did or didn't do was reasonable. That right now, I would imagine, being that they had the original complaint on April the 10th, and what that complaint outlined was the crimes of federal law criminalizing bombings of places of public use in government facilities. And that had all the exhibits, too. Then we had changed it, not changed it, we amended it a bit just to include three more crimes, and they were a federal law that criminalizes acts of terrorism transcending national boundaries, federal law criminalizing providing support to terrorists, and federal law criminalizing the killing of federal government agents and or employees. Now, just looking at that scenario you mentioned, Cheryl, imagine now it's July 30th, they have the two petitions, they have all the evidence, they've had the evidence since April, and now we get a letter in November. So it's not July, it's August, September, October, November, and in November 7th he's saying we have received and reviewed. So they had to review it. And they, it could be a lot to review because those exhibits could take you hours and hours and hours, maybe days to go through it, all right? So they said that they received it and reviewed it, and now they say we will comply with the provisions as they relate to your submission. And that's according to the statute 18 U.S.C. 3332. So I think it's a good bet that they've had it for a while, they've looked at it, they've had some tough decisions to make whether they're going to actually write this letter. This letter, to me, this is so sensitive an issue. And you're talking to the U.S. attorney. And I would believe that this would have to get the okay from the President of the United States. I would believe that.
Oh.
And so we're dealing with a letter that must have run through his over his desk or his advisor's desk. This is not just any letter. This is from the main law enforcement officer in that very district where the all this crime happened down in New York City. So I would think that they certainly begun the process of impaneling grand jurors, or they may even have sworn a special grand jury in, and they may be deliberating. All right? It's been a while now. If you look at it, how it's spread out. Now, that's a very busy district. And what Barbara alluded to as far as the replacement of the chief investigator, we're not the only crime that's being investigated. There's so much stuff going on. So we might say, well, it's because of whatever reason. We don't know the reason that this one person left and another person came on. And it may be because of us. It may be because of a lot of other things. You know, we don't know that. I'm not going to hypothecate on it. And this person, for all I know, may be even better than the previous. But if you just look at it as far as the lawyers' committee, we like the other person, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we'll like this person better. So I would think that right now it's too early to tell again, and we will reach out in our own way to them to try and get some confirmation that things are developing. And as I mentioned, if we feel that they're not, then we have other actions to do.
Okay, well, thank you for that. And I understand that Architects and Engineers has joined together with the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 inquiry for this process. And I'm just wondering, what are your next steps? What do you need? Is there a lot of work left to do for you with this, or do you just get to sit back and wait and see what happens? Richard, maybe you want to start with that?
Well, we're not sitting back. We've got a lot of work to do. And that's why we're in the middle of a fundraising campaign to support the attorneys here primarily, and also ourselves, because we're assembling the credentials of all of these experts, and there'll be dozens of them, and in specific legal formats, and we're assembling their testimony, which has got to be done just right. So that's a lot of work for us, and it's a lot more work for the attorneys who have to continue with motions to keep the U.S. attorney on his task. Dave could talk about that, Barb, too, probably. And so they've got the lion's share of the work. Let's turn it over to them here.
Okay, Barbara?
Well, the bottom line is there's another historic act that has happened, and that is for the first time. I mean, Richard can correct me if I'm incorrect, but I've said it on these radio programs a number of times and haven't been corrected yet. My understanding is that Architects and Engineers, which has been in business since at least 2006, maybe 2005, that's at least 13 years, that Architects and Engineers has never formally partnered with another organization in the past. And beginning on December 10th of last year, 2018, historically, Architects and Engineers and the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry have formally, publicly partnered together on a joint fundraising campaign for the Lawyers Committee and Architects and Engineers, but for the purpose of funding the Architects and Engineers' work that is still ahead of us in order to put the witnesses, the architects, the engineers, the scientists' testimony into the proper legal format for the grand jury and other legal proceedings that we will do in the future, but even more importantly, to fund the Lawyers Committee attorneys, researchers, Freedom of Information Act requesters, follow-up FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request lawsuits when the government doesn't comply with providing us with the documentation that they should. The Lawyers Committee does all of these things, but our real focus for this joint fundraising drive, of course, is explicitly to fund the success of the grand jury for the World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7.
And that may include, as I mentioned before, a mandamus action where we actually go in court. We have to hire an attorney to go into court, and they have to do briefs and things of that nature. And that's the action that would compel them to do what they're supposed to do if we did find out they're not. Meanwhile, as both Richard and Barbara mentioned, there's a lot of preparation. As was mentioned, there's investigations still ongoing with the Freedom of Information actions, and there's the preparation of the professional witnesses and also our lay witnesses. And there's also, hopefully, presentations to the U.S. attorney we'll be invited to make with them. And hopefully, maybe they'll ask for some of our assistance. For a lot of them, this is a new area, just as it will be for, I'm sure, the grand jurors are going to be really surprised with what they see. I'm sure some of the U.S. attorneys that are looking at this, investigators, were surprised by what they saw. And they may hopefully reach out to us. We even talked about possibly, if that was in the cards for this, eventually being invited to go to Congress and making presentations down there. You can imagine if that would come about. So we are needing help in different ways. And if you go to LC4FOR911.org, you can see basically what we're involved with, and you can help out in whatever way you can. You can read the petition, and you can read or watch the exhibits and listen to what the firemen say. It's all very interesting, and actually, perhaps if you're not used to it, stunning or shocking.
And Dave, because Cheryl's listeners are in Connecticut, which isn't that far from New York City, it's a doable trip. Why don't you tell everybody what you know about what I understand is a public event where you and hopefully Julio Gomez and perhaps other members of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry will be holding a public event in New York City, I believe, on January 23rd.
That's right. We'll be at Quaker House, which I don't have the exact address, but we'll be there at 7 p.m. on the 23rd, so Wednesday. I think there's an event there, 7 to 9, which I believe the Truth Action Project is sponsoring. And I will be there, and I actually communicated with Julio today, and he hopes to be there. He plans to be there. He has a little conflict that if he can take care of, he'll be there. So yeah, that's somewhat in the area. Again, if you look up the Quaker House online, you can get the exact address.
I believe it's 15 Rutherford Place, I believe.
You're right. You're 100% right, Barbara.
15 Rutherford Place? Okay.
Yeah, okay. It's near Union Square, I believe. And
okay. And Richard, what is, again, is your website? Maybe you could give that out to people also?
Yes. It's AE, stands for Architects and Engineers, AE911truth.org.
Okay, great. Thank you. And before we pause today, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you'd like the listeners to know? And I ask all of you, so anyone who wants to jump in.
Well, I would just say this, is that the reason that I think all of us are involved, and certainly I don't want to speak for all of us in that way, I'll speak for myself and speak for the Lawyers Committee, is that we really love our country, and we really love the standards which it supposedly represents. We really love the thought of being a beacon of freedom in the world. And I like to say this is, in a sense, a proper investigation into these horrendous crimes is a litmus test to the possibility or the feasibility of our system being able to function and go forward. In other words, if we can't address this problem, we have really, really, really big serious problems as Americans. So I would ask anyone that's listening to get on that website, look at the evidence, read the petition, and if you think there's something funny there, if you think all the cards haven't been put on the table, get involved at some level, somehow, and assert yourself as an American, and assert yourself on behalf of the freedom for yourself and your loved ones, and for the Constitution and the Bill of Rights which protect us. We have to be, as Americans, step forward and say that we're Americans, and this is not coming off on our stand. We were going to preserve our freedoms. And so that's what I would say. Let's preserve our freedoms, and we have to be proactive here. We have to step forward in some way, in the way that feels most comfortable for you. But we have an incredible history. This country is something unlike any country that's ever existed in the world, and we don't want to lose it, because if you lose this flower, it could be a dreaded desert for quite a while, as far as the human race goes and as far as the possibilities we have. We have unlimited possibilities as people, not just in the United States, but the world does. But the United States is sort of the leader. As the United States goes, I believe that's how the world's going to go. So let's do it. Let's get on top of this.
Yeah, well said.
Okay, I'll make a closing statement. I want people to remember what Margaret Mead said. And it's one of, if not her most famous quote, one of her most famous quotes, the great anthropologist. And that was, that I'm going to probably massacre it, but it's words to the effect that never doubt that a small group of dedicated people can make a tremendous difference in the world. In fact, that's all that ever has made a major difference in the world. And, you know, Cheryl, you're talking to the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. You're talking to Richard Gage, who founded and is the head of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And we're just a handful of extraordinary, ordinary citizens who have stepped into the breach that our government has failed us, and we have taken charge of truth, justice, and the American way. And we are going to succeed. We know we're going to succeed. As Dave said, we're feeling our way, but we are 1,000% dedicated to success. We are never going to give up, and it's only a question of time before we succeed.
That's nicely said. Right. And Richard, did you have anything, any final words?
Oh, my God, I'm on the spot here. I certainly, these guys that I'm working with, I'm telling you, they may be lawyers and researchers, but they are extraordinary citizens, patriots, and human beings, as you can tell by those comments. I just want to encourage everybody to do whatever you can. That's what I did 12 years ago. I said, well, I'm an architect. These are buildings. We've been lied to. It really upset me that we've been lied to on such a massive scale, and most Americans are completely unaware that they've been lied to. So when we get hit over the head with a 2x4, we have a choice to make. In this case, the 2x4 is the 2x4 truth. We can do something. Everybody can do something. Sitting on our rear end in front of a computer, we can do a whole lot. And that is get the AE911truth.org link to every architect and engineer that you can find and everybody else that you know. Get the LC4911.org link out there. Tell them that the U.S. attorney is impaneling a grand jury to investigate this evidence. It's no longer conspiracy theory. It's being evaluated by the highest court in the land, basically, if you consider them co-equal, as Barbara highlighted, the grand jury is the fourth branch of government. And so we don't sit back and wait for them to do their job. We alert every American who's currently uninformed to the evidence, to the fact that they, too, have been lied to, that their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren will be paying for the $6.5 trillion global war on terror that's ensued, so everybody can do something to get the word out. Talk to your congressman. Talk to your local media representatives. That's what's needed. That's the need of the hour. Volunteer with our respective organization if that's the only way you can help. Everybody can do something to be a part of truth here. Otherwise, we're part of the problem. Don't be part of the problem.
Okay. All right. Well, David Weisswinkle, Barbara Honegger, and Richard Gage, thank you so very much for all that you do. And thank you for being on the show today. It was really an honor and a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much.
Cheryl.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
The most famous whistleblower of the 20th century, Daniel Ellsberg, who changed the course of the Vietnam War by releasing the Pentagon Papers, recounts his experiences as a whistleblower and gives his thoughts on Chelsea Manning, the former Army intelligence analyst who provided archives of secret military documents to WikiLeaks in 2010, exposing our government's lies about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We are deeply grateful for him spending some time with us. And I do want to begin with some of your own sense about your journey and why the issue of freedom for whistleblowers, freedom of speech, is such a hallmark of what at least is an effort to accomplish democracy within a society.
I identify with Chelsea Manning and with Ed Snowden. We went through the same trajectory of first feeling that the most patriotic and useful thing we could do was to serve the executive branch or the military of the U.S. government, and came to realize that that could contradict our duties as a citizen and our sworn oaths to uphold and support the Constitution of the United States. We found ourselves participating in policies that were very contradictory to our own Constitution and to our national security and to our welfare. These policies were criminal. That goes on in every administration and in every government to a considerable extent. And they were being conducted in secret, and we were being expected to keep those secrets as well as participate in those policies. That contradicted our oath to support and defend the Constitution. At the time, I wasn't too conscious of the obligations I'd assumed under the Constitution. I didn't really think it applied to me because I worked for the president. I worked for the Secretary of Defense, who was working for the president. And we didn't really think of ourselves as bound by laws, treaties, any more than the president did. And as I said, we came to realize, each of us, that that was inconsistent with the welfare of our own country. And in the case of Vietnam, we were pursuing an unjustified war, killing people in Vietnam and sending Americans to kill and be killed for no justifiable, legitimate reason. That, to me, came to seem murder, unjustified homicide. And it was something I should not participate in at all anymore, and I should expose it and try to stop it. That was in 1969, and I knew that the war was going to continue under Richard Nixon. I knew that because I'd worked for Richard Nixon at the beginning of his administration, late 68, before he came into office, and consulted from the RAND Corporation. And I had contacts then in the White House and elsewhere in Vietnam that gave me the inside knowledge that Nixon was making threats that were going to prolong the war and expand it, which is what did happen. To try to avert that, I finally decided to follow the example of young draft resistors who were going to prison, some of whom I met. I think that was crucial to my own change. And they were going to prison to protest a war that they and I saw as wrong. And it made me realize that if I wanted to shorten this war or end it as I did, I was ready to go to prison since they were. I followed their example. So I copied 7,000 pages of top secret documents on the decision-making in Vietnam. That was the title of it. from 1945 to 1968. It ended before the current president, Nixon, came into office, so it didn't incriminate him directly. But I knew that he was following in the paths of his four predecessors, and he was lying to the public as to what he was doing. And then he was making threats that were going to expand the war as they had done. So I hoped that by revealing that past record, it might make people more skeptical and probing of his policy, and it might lead them to end it. Actually, it didn't do that. People were not willing to extrapolate from the past presidents, four of them, to the current one, even if they hadn't voted for him. They didn't want to believe that the president currently could be really lying to him, even if his predecessors had been. In that respect, I didn't find success. Ironically, Nixon was so worried that I would reveal secrets about his administration and perhaps documents that people inside his National Security Council had given to me, that he took criminal actions to shut me up. He went into my former psychoanalyst's office to get information to blackmail me into silence, wiretapped me without a warrant, overheard me on warrantless wiretaps of others. He sent people to incapacitate me on the steps of the Capitol on May 3rd, 1972. All these were crimes which he had to cover up and which he could pretty well count on covering up as a president, but his luck ran out. Some of the very people who'd been involved in this were caught in the Watergate doing other crimes for him in connection with the campaign. He had to keep them silent by bribing them into silence and perjury. Those were new crimes of obstruction of justice, the kind of thing that the current president is accused of right now. We haven't seen the evidence on it, but that's what's in the air right now, and so we could see a similar history. The effect of that was when that was in fact exposed, because the people in the Watergate were caught and eventually did come clean. After some of them did, the others began revising their testimony, and Nixon was faced with impeachment and even prosecution and led to resign, and that made the war endable. So this was a case where what they now call whistleblowing, where truth-telling of misdoing, of wrongdoing within an agency or a government or a corporation is exposed to authorities or to the public in order to change these misdeeds. This is a case where what I did was a link in a chain of events that led to the shortening of the war. So it was a success. I thought that success might encourage other people to do the same. In the end, I wasn't imprisoned by an almost miraculous set of revelations, which I've just described. Nobody could count on that sort of thing. But I did think that people could see that it was worth taking a risk to enlighten the public about the truth in order to shorten the war to prevent major governmental crimes, as Ed Snowden revealed in connection with criminal surveillance of people. That didn't happen. 39 years went by, and although there were leaks, and many of them were very useful, they were very limited. They didn't have the wholesale revelations that are really necessary to prove a case. Until Chelsea Manning, 39 years later, I'd almost given up that anybody would do what I'd done, essentially. Chelsea Manning did do that. She faced life in prison, even the possibility of capital punishment in her case in the military, and did serve 7.5 years in prison until President Obama commuted her sentence. Then 3 years later, after she did that, Ed Snowden revealed an even larger amount of information about illegal surveillance by the National Security Agency. And that made people aware in the world for the first time of the massive scale of this Big Brother type of surveillance by not only the American government, but other governments as well. So, and Chelsea had significant impact also in her revelations. So although she paid a very heavy price, and she's, of course, now back in jail for refusing to participate in what is basically an assault by this administration on the freedom of the press, targeting WikiLeaks, to which she had given her information, including a video called Collateral Murder, which I encourage people to look up on YouTube, Collateral Murder, which shows acts of murder by a helicopter crew of unarmed civilians in the ground below them in Iraq of a kind that took place every day, essentially, by reports of other people in Iraq, and revealed a number of other things. They want her now to speak to a grand jury that is trying to find some grounds on which to indict Julian Assange in particular and other people connected with WikiLeaks. There are grounds quick to their hand there. There have been reports that he might be indicted, Julian, on the same grounds I was. I was the first to be indicted for revealing information to the American people and the first prosecution under the Espionage Act or theft. But they're not anxious to do that to a journalist because it so clearly contradicts the First Amendment, freedom of the press, as well as freedom of speech. They'd prefer to find other grounds, and I think they're hoping to get Chelsea to add to her many, many hours of previous testimony under oath in ways that would maybe enable them to think up some new charges to bring against him that would not apply to the New York Times, because basically what she did was what I did in 71 and giving information to the New York Times. She offered it to the New York Times, by the way, before she went to WikiLeaks, and also to the Washington Post, to which I had also given the Pentagon Papers 39 years earlier. But they both turned their noses up at that. They didn't pick up on it. So she went to WikiLeaks. There is, I think, the government investigation now of WikiLeaks and Julian Assange is a first step toward indicting and prosecuting and imprisoning, if possible, journalists and publishers. Julian is essentially a publisher, and not just sources like me or Chelsea or Ed Snowden. After my case, there were exactly two other cases before President Obama. One of those was dismissed, as mine was dismissed for governmental misconduct. Obama tripled that score, had 9 prosecutions. But they were still old sources, not of journalists. And the Obama administration backed off from indicting WikiLeaks or Julian Assange on the realization that they'd really done nothing that the New York Times hadn't done in publishing these very facts and revelations, and the Post and the Guardian and a lot of other papers. And the Obama administration chose not blatantly to violate the First Amendment by going after the press. Trump is less restrained by that concern. But even he and his DOJ, Department of Justice, wants to find other basis, if he can, that will not apply to the New York Times, to find some indication that Assange or WikiLeaks overstepped the bounds of journalism in some way by encouraging the leak of classified information, by specifically helping Chelsea break codes or do something. Advice she didn't, help she did not need and did not get, and she's sworn otherwise. But they would like testimony that contradicts her earlier testimony. It doesn't have to be true. In effect, they're torturing her by putting her back in jail. Not only her, you know, a lot of people are tortured by being in solitary, for example. But it's torture trying to get what torture gets, which is false confessions. That's what it does do and what it's used for and can often be effective. That doesn't always work. And it won't work on Chelsea. But putting her back in jail will be a cautionary example to other people who might move in her direction, and of which I would say there should be more. We need more, not less whistleblowers. But that's not the attitude of any government. And they're putting her back in now, I think, as part of this process, which she refuses to be party to. She's one of the most patriotic people and conscientious people I've ever heard of or known in this country. And I admire her very much. She's a hero of mine, as is Snowden, who is in essentially permanent exile for doing what Chelsea did or for what I did. I hope there will be a public awareness that this process against the press is an attack on our democracy. It's on our basic rights and what makes us a democratic republic. If they are successful in getting a conviction of Julian Assange, the New York Times will not be too far behind that, and the free press will be a thing of the past.
Danielle Ellsberg, I want to mention that Chelsea Manning said, "I will not participate in a secret process that I morally object to, particularly one that has been historically used to entrap and prosecute activists for protected political speech, and that is, of course, referring to resisting the grand jury. I wonder about your thoughts on the grand jury process that has so often been used to decapitate, smash people who are powerless, their organization, or people such as yourself and Chelsea who resist the collective oppression or silencing of people who wish to reveal the truth of a society.
I believe I've become more educated on that problem just in the last few days than I was earlier, because I looked up the history of grand juries a bit on the web and learned quite a bit from that, more than I knew before, about the way they have been used to repress, for example, the civil rights movement, the labor movement, and other activist movements in this country and elsewhere. I didn't realize that grand juries were as problematic as Chelsea was aware, apparently. And that's the case. So she is protesting a process that is very often abused, and in this case is being abused in order, as I say, to rescind the First Amendment, the freedom of the press, significantly. It's being, this is the first president who has openly declared the press the enemy of the people, an expression used both by the Nazis and by Stalin against dissenters in their authoritarian societies. And it's fairly brazen of Trump actually even to quote that very ill-famed phrase, enemy of the people. Other presidents have regarded the press as their personal enemies in some way. Nixon thought that way. But he said it on the tapes. He said it in private and not as a public theme. So it's a warning cry to us that we hear our president actually taking that position. And Chelsea is directly challenging it. I wouldn't respect her less if she, under face of going to prison, actually went ahead and participated, as others have and others will. But I admire her all the more, as I did before, for being that principled, to be willing to go back to jail where she had a very hard time for 7.5 years, for being willing to go back to that rather than participate in this process.
Do you think that the issue of freedom of press or government lying to its citizenry is, are we in a more fragile state now? Are we in as perilous a condition as we were during the Vietnam War, or perhaps even more so? I'm interested in your sense of where the protections of our Constitution are at this juncture in time and under this administration.
I'm not sure that Trump actually lies on important matters more than other presidents. They all did, the ones I worked for, and all of them did, and not just in this country. As the journalist I.F. Stone used to say, all government officials lie and nothing they say is to be believed, meaning not that they lie in everything they say, although Trump comes pretty close to that, he's unusual there, but that anything they say may be a lie, and it's not the last word. It needs to be checked against other evidence, and in some cases that evidence can only be people who are willing to tell the truth at risk to their own careers. But now, what's the difference now? Well, we have a president now who lies so frequently and so blatantly that it's not even an insult to call him a liar anymore. In the olden days, I think I know that I would have been thrown off of a radio program if I called the president a liar. Well, that hasn't been true since Watergate, really, or since the Pentagon Papers. It's certainly not true now. So we take it as a matter of course. But in terms of lying on important matters, not the size of crowds or something, but on matters of planning for war or reasons for going to war, that has always been a major problem, and it is one today. If we go to war against Iran, which would be a catastrophe in many ways, as well as a major crime against peace, the reasons given would be as false as they were for Vietnam or Iraq. And obviously that is a major danger right now, with Trump's National Security Advisor John Bolton having been, his career has almost been based on trying to promote a war with Iran. We do need to rely on whistleblowers really revealing that, and other people speaking honestly and freely about the situation. and press that is willing to challenge the president's policy, as the Times did not in the case of Iraq or in Vietnam until the Pentagon Papers. So the press doesn't have a wonderful record on that, but there are times when they have taken the risk, even of prosecution, as in the Pentagon Papers case, and as they will be doing now under this president. There have been times when they've risen to that challenge and conducted what amounted to civil disobedience in the sense of defying an attorney general who said this is dangerous to the safety of the United States, as they said in the case of the Pentagon Papers, falsely, or the case of Chelsea Manning, where they have not come up with a single instance where anything she revealed actually harmed anyone or harmed the legitimate interests of the United States. They would have loved to come up with that, and they weren't able to. If we are to be a country where the people are sovereign in an ultimate sense and have the ability to make informed decisions and that influence the actual course of events, and that's true here only to a limited extent, but it is true to a limited extent, and that's more than a lot of other countries in the world, and that's worth one's life to preserve, I would say. As Snowden put it, there are some things worth dying for, as Chelsea Manning said directly to her informant, the one who informed on her, she was willing to go to prison for life or even be executed, he said, to put out this information. So that's a spirit that I felt that I identify with, and I believe it's true today. We need that truth-telling today, and we always will.
Your thoughts on the incredible saber-rattling of the U.S. against, indeed it would seem far more than saber-rattling, against Venezuela, and the press fanning the flames of war, similarly for regime change in Venezuela. How do you understand and look at that, as you've certainly become for years now known as a major peace activist?
It is a serious situation. There is actual talk and prospect of the U.S. sending combat troops to Venezuela, which would be the first time we've ever exerted our imperial influence in that way in South America. We've done it very often in Central America. I don't know of an instance where we've done what is clearly being threatened right now, which is to send troops to South America in circumstances that they don't even pretend involve any threat to the security of the United States. So it would be clearly a crime against the peace. In terms of our intervention there now, the talk of regime change, our policy in the world for a long time, but certainly in the whole post-war period, has been one of intervention and covert intervention, generally clandestine, in pursuit of regime change of countries whose governments did not serve very specifically U.S. corporate interests. What is new is that both parties and a lot of our allies are actually talking openly about our right and our need to conduct regime change. That's mind-boggling even for me, and I'm not exactly naive on this. I'm very familiar with that inside belief that that was our right and our need in many countries in the world, covertly, and lying about it, denying it, keeping it secret, relying on whistleblowers to reveal that that was our intention. Here, it doesn't take a whistleblower to say that both parties are talking about bringing about regime change, possibly with military means. That is the definition of empire, and we generally think of ourselves wrongly as non-imperial and as believing in self-determination everywhere, which has never been true in the Third World in particular, in the former colonial areas. We haven't been that blatant about it, as I say, in South America. We really have been pretty blatant in Central America, although even so, most people don't realize how much we were involved in Guatemala or El Salvador or Nicaragua. These other things were done clandestinely. This ties in with an instance of mixed performance by the media as well as the government. For once, the New York Times has revealed that they were mistaken earlier. They conveyed false information that the Maduro government had burned aid shipments and trucks specifically on a bridge going to Venezuela. At some point, they looked again, or they looked at newly released videos and noticed that it was so-called protesters, not the government, who had thrown firebombs, Molotov cocktails, that had caused the fire. But meanwhile, the media just across the board had cooperated right away in accepting government claims that the Maduro government had done this. This is obviously, by the way, as a basis for justifying military intervention. The kind of false information, like the Tonkin Gulf incidents in August of 1964, and which led to 9 years of bombing of North Vietnam, began at that point. Well, here is a case where there was misinformation conveyed, and I think it's a very fair question to ask, how long was it that the government knew that that information was false before they allowed it to be known to the public? And for another matter, who were the protesters who threw the firebombs at all? I'm not saying that I know who they were. I'm saying that I think it's a very fair question to ask now, to say, who were they? Who were they serving? Who paid them? What was going on here? Because we have a situation where the leaders of our government, in an almost unprecedented way, are talking about possible military intervention in a country that where we don't even pretend to have a security interest in that situation. That shows where we've come to in the way of accepting an imperial role in the world. In the nuclear age, that is extremely dangerous to the survival of civilization, humanity. Not in Venezuela directly. That's just a small part of a policy that is extremely reckless in the world. And by the way, we're not the only ones who do that, who act that way. It's dangerous on all sides. So more truth-telling, more democracy than we have right now is called for, I think, if we're to go on.
As we wrap up, Mr. Ellsberg, again, your thoughts about Chelsea Manning and bringing Chelsea Manning back to the beloved community.
The objections she's making to the grand jury process are very valid in general, although there no doubt have been some cases where a grand jury acted legitimately, and there's some areas, perhaps, against organized crime, where it has served a legitimate purpose. It is now clearly serving the illegitimate purpose of attempting to silence dissent and to silence the free press generally. She is acting heroically, I would say, Chelsea Manning, in a willingness to go to jail to expose and protest participation in this process against the free press. And I think in her own case, as a person who had surgery recently, special needs, who asked actually for house arrest after being charged with contempt because of her medical needs, to send her back into jail where those needs will not be met, even if the government made a good faith effort to meet those needs. They won't be met in jail. And obviously that doesn't apply only to her, it applies to many other people. But in her case, we have a case of a patriot acting heroically in our interests, and certainly a campaign of which I'm part to free Chelsea Manning gets wide support.
Daniel Ellsberg, for your lifetime of work towards peace and justice, towards equal rights and justice, and to bring about the promise of democracy, thank you so much for spending time with us. You are extremely gracious and very much appreciated.
Well, thank you. And, I appreciate your ability there to bring public light to the injustice that's being done to Chelsea. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Much appreciated, sir.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
that TV Island is a diverse community. There is gays, there's lesbians, there's bisexuals.
There's a whole range.
Yeah, the whole range.
Sister Girl is just a name that we sort of created for ourselves.
How do you feel?
Good, very good. We're so excited to be here. First time.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Pink tourism money is still green in repressive Malaysia. Another blocked U.S. military trans ban gets bushwhacked. And Tiwi Island sister girls are doing it for themselves. Those stories and more this week, now that you've tuned into This Way Out.
I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Carol Myers.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news interaffecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 9th, 2019. In response to a question at a travel conference in Berlin this week about how safe it is for Jews and LGBTQ people in his country, Tourism Minister Datuk Mohamedin bin Khattabi claimed that there are no LGBTQ people in Malaysia. He told German broadcaster Deutsche Welle that, "I don't think we have anything like that in our country." The government came under fire earlier this year when it tried to ban Israeli athletes from an international swim meet. The tourism ministry issued a statement less than 2 days later claiming to clarify Mohamedin's pronouncement by saying that there are no plans for a Malaysia tourism campaign in the LGBTQ community. As a main tourism destination in Asia, the statement added, Malaysia has never and will not do anything to stop our guests based on their sexual orientation, religion, and cultural belief. That's little comfort to Malaysia's homegrown queer citizens, who have been under relentless attack by a number of high-ranking government officials, including the Prime Minister, for the past few years. Police raids on popular queer venues and verbal and physical assaults by thugs against people perceived to be LGBTQ are common. Several government jurisdictions have established so-called change clinics for transgender people. Queer rights activist Numan Afifi told The Advocate that erasure of our existence will not only just trivialize our struggle, but also perpetuate the injustices towards us. Anthony Chong, who advocates for Malaysia's queer, deaf community, told the news outlet that minority communities, not only LGBTQ people, but also people with disabilities and indigenous people, are ashamed at how our ministers run our government. The country's criminal code, a gift from British colonizers to Malaysia's mostly Muslim 32 million people, punishes consenting adults convicted of engaging in same-gender sex with up to 20 years in prison.
Lawmakers in Taiwan are being battered by opposing forces as they deliberate some form of legal recognition for the island's same-gender couples. The Constitutional Court ruled in May 2017 that denying civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples was unconstitutional. The judges gave the legislative yuan 2 years to remedy the situation. If legislators fail to pass the bill before the May 24th deadline this year, the court said that marriage equality would automatically take effect. Groups on the right, led by the anti-queer Happiness of the Next Generation Alliance, are demanding that a separate category outside of marriage be created, which would reflect the majority vote on the issue in ballot measures the group sponsored last November. Local media reported this week that 20 lawmakers from the ruling party and 9 minority party members have signed on to a draft bill that would restrict the use of words such as marriage and spouse to heterosexual couples and raise the age of consent for lesbian and gay couples to 20. According to Taiwan News, Canadian diplomat Michael McCullough nevertheless called the island's progress on introducing a marriage bill a win for the people of the world. However, the government is trying to have it both ways. The draft bill submitted by Taiwan's cabinet on February 21st, called the Enforcement Act of Judicial Yuan, Interpretation Number 748, doesn't alter the civil code to include same-gender couples, but creates a separate category for them. Activists have suggested that the exhausting fight over anti-queer ballot measures last November has tempered community enthusiasm for a further fight in the Constitutional Court if the final version of the bill fails to extend all the rights of civil marriage to same-gender couples.
A U.S. federal judge in Maryland this week eliminated one of two remaining obstacles that have prevented the implementation of Donald Trump's ban on military service by qualified transgender people. U.S. District Judge George Russell III agreed with the Trump administration's claim that because a recent Supreme Court ruling lifted two of the injunctions in California and Washington state, while legal challenges continue in lower courts, there was no reason to keep his injunction in place. According to the ACLU, one active case remains that keeps the trans ban at bay, Doe v. Trump, in a D.C. court. Military service by transgender people is still governed by the Obama-era policy, instituted in 2016, that lifted a ban on qualified trans troops and allowed them to seek medical transition care. When asked about this week's lifting of another injunction, Pentagon spokeswoman Jessica Maxwell told CNN that the Defense Department is expected to issue further guidance, which will be forthcoming in the near future. While not surprising, ACLU staff attorney Joshua Bell said the Maryland court injunction being lifted is deeply disappointing. Each and every claim made by President Trump to justify this ban can be easily debunked by the conclusions drawn from the Department of Defense's own review process.
Catching up on recent U.S. state news, the Iowa Supreme Court ruled unanimously on March 8th that the state's ban on Medicaid coverage for certifiably necessary surgical care for transgender individuals violated the Gender Identity Protections in Iowa's Civil Rights Act. The state's Department of Human Services argued unsuccessfully that the surgeries were cosmetic, reconstructive, or plastic, performed primarily for psychological purposes.
Missouri's Supreme Court overruled the lower court dismissal of a lawsuit filed by a transgender male teen who's challenging his school district's refusal to let him use the boys' bathroom and locker room facilities on campus. The high court said that the teen, who's lived as male since the age of 9, has the right to sue under Missouri's Human Rights Act for discrimination based on sex. In a separate ruling issued the same day, the Missouri Supreme Court also opened the door to other lawsuits by gay people charging sex discrimination, even though the state has no specific laws banning bias based on sexual orientation.
Tennessee's Attorney General Herbert Slattery, in response to a lawmaker's question in mid-February, confirmed that transgender people are protected by existing legislation criminalizing hate crimes motivated by gender. It's believed to be the first southern state to specifically include transgender people in its hate crime laws.
The Colorado House of Representatives passed a bill banning so-called conversion therapy for minors that claims to make queer people straight. Similar bills have repeatedly failed in the Republican-controlled Senate. But now that Democrats have the majority, thanks to the November elections, passage there now seems likely. And the signature of openly gay Governor Jared Polis is a foregone conclusion. It would make Colorado the 16th U.S. state to ban the bogus practice.
But a similar proposal has died in the Utah legislature after the Republican governor and GOP lawmakers couldn't agree on whether or not to allow a therapist to counsel a minor about changing sexual orientation while also swearing not to try to do that.
And measures to ban bias based on sexual orientation have failed, again, in both the North Dakota and Nebraska state legislatures. Meanwhile, the mayor of Alaska's second biggest city vetoed an ordinance this week that was approved by the city council to extend sweeping human rights protections to LGBTQ people. Fairbanks Mayor Jim Matherly said he wanted to put the issue on the October ballot and let the people decide.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? Won't you be my neighbor?
It all started with a tweet that went viral. Mr. Rogers, the venerable children's TV host who told all of his young viewers that he liked them just the way they were, was apparently bisexual. A well-known YouTuber cited Maxwell King's 2018 biography, The Good Neighbor, The Life and Work of Fred Rogers. While he's not on record identifying as bisexual, Rogers did describe his sexual attraction as fluid. The revelation lit up the internet this week, with most queer friends celebrating, though a few hetero critics said it would have been inappropriate for children if Rogers' bisexuality had been known at the time. During conversations with openly gay Dr. William Hirsch, Rogers reportedly said that he's right smack in the middle of the Kinsey scale and said he found both men and women attractive. One queer tweet expressed surprise that,
as a Presbyterian minister, Rogers ever stated anything so clearly. I do not find it hard to believe he was just that kind of a person, but I am delightfully shocked he ever said even that much. Rogers died in 2003, 2 years after his show ended, following more than 3 decades on the air.
And finally, Michael McConnell and Jack Baker applied for and got a marriage license in Erth County, Minnesota, in 1971. The clerk didn't realize that both applicants were male. It made headlines around the world, even though authorities refused to recognize the marriage. The U.S. Supreme Court finally opened the civil institution to same-gender couples in 2015. But McConnell and Baker have spent the past 5 decades trying to get their marriage legally recognized. At long last, the McConnells, Jack took Michael's last name, received a letter in mid-February from the Social Security Administration, officially validating their 1971 marriage. After 48 years of wedded bliss, they're now believed to be the most enduring legally married same-gender couple in the United States, and maybe in the world.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending March 9th, 2019. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Gray Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the ever-updating thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
Year, the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras brings people from far and near to celebrate Pride with festivals, parties, and the world-famous Grand Parade. The events go on from February to early March. For many, it's the experience of a lifetime. 2 years ago, a group of transgender women from the unique Aboriginal culture of the Tiwi Islands shared that experience for the first time. These sister girls traveled 2,000 miles from the top end of Australia's Northern Territory, where they've been making impressive progress achieving acceptance. This Way Out's Barry McKay met with some of the sister girls while they were in Sydney and chatted with them about their lives, their community-centered work back home, and how they got their name.
Could you introduce yourselves?
Sean Caranoa.
Anastasia Begona.
And what made you decide to come down here to Sydney?
It's all about being together as one and showcasing the Tiwi culture on it at an international stage.
And why did you want to come to Mardi Gras specifically?
We have never experienced a Mardi Gras in our life, so we wanted to come down to Sydney to join with others that have been marching for years, you know, and we wanted to, you know, celebrate the unique of marching for.
Are you excited?
Yeah, we are.
Third time down here, but the first march, yeah, for Mardi Gras.
How do Tiwi Islanders think of gender roles between the male and female?
How do they think? It's not a thinking perspective.
Yeah.
It's more or less of a...
Adapting and accepting.
And accepting on who we are.
Are there strict gender roles that males do one thing and females do another thing?
Well, yes, there is, but there's no strict rules for anyone that identified for LGBTIQ. Through Aboriginal culture, they say that the first child who is male is supposed to be... what should I refer to? Like the chief or a boss of that family. So it's more as in continue on with the culture and knowledge and law. That's what the first child would do, and especially being male. But as for myself, I'm the eldest child for my parents, and you know, being a sister girl, I still have knowledge and culture, laws that I have to obey, and you know, observe to, but I continue on to do it as whatever roles that I play, and to continue on doing. I can either do it in female, I can either do it in male. So it's more accepting what roles that you take on.
Is it difficult if you're first born and you turn out as same-sex attracted?
At first it's difficult because, you know, a lot of family, I think it's got to do with missionaries as well. There's a lot of predominant Catholic for the islands to have it. They were influenced by that. But certainly it has changed a lot nowadays that family do accept if anyone's identified as a sister girl or gay man or bisexual or lesbian. It's very accepting now.
Especially when you have a supportive family, it all starts back with your family. Again, like I said, if you have your, you know, family supporting you, that again gives you more of an opportunity to come out and be accepting from your own people.
So could you tell me what a sister girl is? How would you define the word?
So sister girl means transgender, because at that early stage of generation, when there's girls that was fighting for acceptance, they came up with the word sister girl to have a more appropriate word approach towards a transgender person instead of calling them trannies or transsexual. So that's how it all started. But generation, when I talk about generation, you know, there's a lot of generations on the island that is sister girl. We talk about how the Tiwi Island is a diverse community. There is gays, there's lesbians, there's bisexuals.
There's a whole range.
Yeah, the whole range.
Sister girl is just a name that we sort of created for ourselves
as
an appropriate way as we approach each other. We treat each other like sisters.
What's the word in the Tiwi language and what does it mean in English?
Well, there's only one word in Tiwi Island for gay, and that's in Balinyini. But it's just we try not to use that word because it's very hurtful for someone if you're describing someone who identify as the LGBTIQ. You know, it's a Tiwi word that it's very.
Okay, so it means someone who's attracted to the same sex, but it's got a bad negative connotation.
Well,
that's what it is. Again, Balinyini is sort of a word to... They use that word as a Balinyini as a direct arrow to towards our soul and try and break us down. But these Jilamari girls aren't very strong girls and unafraid to get back up and continue on their everyday lives.
Why do you think gender diverse people exist?
It's just freedom of range.
That's right.
I think it's freedom of we're not all trapped in, you know, in a different body, you know. At the first generation, there were trannies, transgenders, you know, sister girls that came out being trapped in the wrong body. Then they were the ones that paved the ways for the sister girl community on the island. Then the new generation starts to flow in, and there were different girls that wanted to not be different, but they wanted to be true to their self and be true to their body and soul and spiritual as well.
Hi, I'm Lacey Dunhaman.
And I'm No Vagina.
And we are the Dreamtime Divas,
one of Australia's leading Aboriginal drag acts.
And you're listening to
This Way Out,
the weekly global community radio show produced by,
for and about the world's diverse sexual and gender variant minorities
and those who love them.
Hi, I'm Barry Mackay in Sydney, Australia, and I'm chatting with two of the Aboriginal Tiwi Island Sister Girls group, Sean Karanoa and Anastasia Vagona, who first attended the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras in 2017.
How difficult is it for a young child growing up in the Tiwi Islands who discovers themselves to be different in their sexual orientation?
How difficult.
It's really difficult when you don't have the support network within your own family. And for a person or a child growing up and trying to find himself or find herself, again, looks back towards the family. And the family really needs to put in mind that you are the ones that's, you know, going to make it comfortable for you to walk around and accept yourself.
How do sister girls find themselves, so each other? How do you find network up with each other when you're in such remote communities?
Again, we're all close with each other, sisters. Again, the other girls, we make weekends with the girls on Melville Island, so we pretty much...
We gather, we sing, we dance together, we have laughed, we joke.
You don't have sex with each other.
Yeah, it's we don't.
Where the sister girls plays a very important part of that. We don't have sex with each other.
Who do you have sex with?
The other agendas out there. Such as bisexuals,
straight
men's, yeah, so...
Closet.
Yeah.
Yeah, closet. But going back on sister girls, why can't sister girls have sex with each other? Because there is culture, and there's kinship, and there is tribe. So culture, kinship, and tribe is the main three important things that... I'll give you an example. Anastasia here is my daughter. In Aboriginal way, I am not allowed to have sex with her because she is my daughter. Her mother is my sister, and that's it's telling me that there is a kinship between the family kinship line, and there is the tribe where it comes. There's a Pacific tribe that you have to marry. So the tribe comes from your mother, and so your mother tribes give you the identity of who you belong within the tribe clan. So there's four tribes. The top tribe is the sun. The bottom tribe is the rock. And on the side of those two groups, top and bottom, are the fish, the mullet fish and the pedanus fish. And so the sun is only allowed to marry the fish, the mullet trip and the pedanus. They're not allowed to marry the rock clan. Mm. And that same goes with the other two. Mullet and the pandanus, they're not allowed to marry each other. They're allowed to marry the sun or the rock. So that's the kingship, and that's the tribe. So it's not, you know, that's the law of the Tiwi Island. It's been on for thousands of years. So.
And we still play an important part of that, passing on knowledge. And that's how we still probably want to keep it that way. Again, using that sister girl title or name.
It's not hard.
It's not hard nowadays, because now we've got Facebook, and then you have all these other sort of apps and stuff. Yeah. So we're pretty not isolated people. We're pretty much up there with the technologies. We all have phones. Yeah. We all SMS each other.
Snapchat.
Yeah, or commonly, or you might know it as inboxing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we still do that. So it's not hard for us. But it's just harder for us to find the men, the Tiwi men. Yeah.
Yeah.
We can't, live with them because...
Culture.
Of culture reasons.
Mm. Do you experience discrimination and racism differently from others in the top end?
Not really, not different. I guess there's not much of a
discrimination.
Yeah, there's nothing different. Just basic stigma, homophobic.
Just the same things.
Yeah, same things.
Who inspires you? What sort of music do you like?
Oh. Well, mine will probably be Janet Jackson. she's very feminine, you know, she's very out there. Even though she's she's very political with some things, but her music tells a lot of stories, and that's where, you know, you don't want to connect to the artist's personal life, but you want to connect to the artist, what she, you know, the artist is doing, you know, through the music is one massive important way to connect to. So.
Before the parade, I spoke to the head of the Tiwi Islands Sister Girls group, Crystal Love, and had a quick chat to a few of the others in the group. How difficult is it if you are gay to find a relationship on the Tiwi Islands?
Yes, we do have problems, but you know what, at the end of the day, we have to fight for our right to find Aboriginal culture, need to define and define us as couples. But you know, at the end of the day, we have to make ourselves available and truth, you know, because at the end of the day, it's not about how can we do it, but we can do it together as a cultural. And we have to do it because we have to do it, because that's our lives. We live our lives the way we live.
I understand this. You've had some problems with suicide. What happened?
Yes, it was a high rate of suicide. But, you know,
what's happened?
At the end of the day, you know, we deal with it, and, you know, we deal with the best we can. And, you know, we help each other because of our spiritual beliefs.
How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling great. And we lost some sister girls a couple of days ago, but, you know, they're all in spirit. Yeah, press pause, yeah.
Okay. How do you feel?
Good, very good. I'm so excited to be here. First time.
How are you feeling?
Oh, I've still got that bit of nerves in my feelings, so, but it's okay. I'm doing it good.
Yeah.
And we're all excited and ready. Yeah. Headed out as Mardi Gras 2017.
I'm Barry Mackay in Sydney, Australia, and if you'd like to check out the interview on video and see some of the Sister Girls' beautifully handmade costumes and their first attendance at the Sydney Mardi Gras in 2017, just head to thiswayout.org.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Sarah Sweeney and Carol Myers, produced with Brian DeShazer, and from Barry McKay. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, Paul Bannon, Christopher Matthews, Dred Proctor and Brian Burns, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley, and all of the listener donors who make this program possible. You can join them by visiting thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 2CCC, Gosford, New South Wales, WRIR, Richmond, Virginia, KRCC, HD2, Colorado Springs, Colorado, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. The state, many on the radical left believe, the state is corrupt and undemocratic. It is, in this country and so many others, obedient to and ultimately controlled by the capitalist class. So what's the use, the argument goes, of engaging with the state? What's the use of electoral politics, of trying to change the system from within, of attempting to reform the capitalist system and state to make it a bit gentler around the edges? Fundamental social and political transformation, many leftists argue, must come from outside state institutions. People, ordinary people, must create their own institutions, must create the world they want to see, and not get their hands dirty with the business of running and joining political parties that vie for state power. It's a compelling argument, but one that my guest finds deficient in certain respects. Paul Christopher Gray teaches political science and labor studies at Brock University in Ontario, Canada. And his new book, his new edited book, is From the Streets to the State, Changing the World by Taking Power. When Paul Christopher Gray joined me recently, I asked what motivated him to produce this volume.
I would say about 9 or 10 years ago, I came to believe that capitalist society is an inherently unequal society, and that those inequalities were the result of being historically imposed rather than the result of any natural inequalities or hierarchies within humankind. So I got politically active and was trying to see if there might be alternatives to capitalism, because if indeed capitalism is inherently unequal or unjust, there might not be an alternative that is better to it, and we might just have to reform capitalism as best we can. And I think one of the most influential ideas that I encountered early on while I was getting politically active and looking for alternatives was something like Holloway's slogan, change the world without taking power. And I think we can refer to this tendency, this milieu, as a kind of anti-power politics. Essentially, what it means is the state, the government, the most powerful institutions in our society are inherently illegitimate and co-opting. And so, therefore, if we are going to try to transform society for the better, we should avoid these institutions at all costs. We should try to build alternatives outside of them.
Holloway is John Holloway, who in 2002 wrote a book called Change the World Without Taking Power. So, yeah, let's spend a little time on Holloway, because you, in this book, push back against what he is saying, what he is arguing. So he does not want to engage with the state. He does not believe in electoral politics or this idea, this ambition of winning government office. So tell us more about what kinds of institutions and organizing he would like to see happen, or he thinks needs to happen in order to change the world.
Well, what's interesting about John Holloway is that in the 70s and the 80s, he was actually one of the most articulate defenders of the idea of trying to work both in and against the state, both inside and against government, outside of government as well. And sometime during the 1990s, he had a change of heart. And I think that this was inspired in large part by the Zapatistas in the southernmost state of Mexico, in Chiapas. And they had attempted to create an autonomous region in which the government and military forces were not able to enter so that they could engage in forms of self-governance. And Holloway theorized this and tried to generalize it so that it could be implemented beyond the Zapatista experience. And in doing so, he tapped into a longer-term tradition of what you might describe as dual power or diarchy or autonomism. There are a variety of different names and sub-traditions within it. But generally, the idea is that because electoral politics is not genuinely representative, because the government or the state is an institution based primarily in coercion and is unaccountable to the broader population, and because the government and the state as a set of institutions seem to co-opt and to subvert the principles of everyone who would try to change the world for the better by using them, by operating within them, this broader tradition that Holloway is tapping into attempts to create institutions that are an alternative to the state. So it might be a network of more democratic unions, of neighborhood councils, of workers' councils, where workers are actually creating committees and fighting for demands beyond economic demands like wage increases, but for more participation in the decisions of the actual companies that they work for, cooperatives, militias, and the like. And ultimately, the goal is, in one way or another, to create these alternative institutions in the shadows of the state and en masse to withdraw from our acquiescence to government, to the state, and to contend for power with it by asking people to participate in these alternative institutions.
How influential has this anti-power politics been or become among radical leftists?
I would say that it has been quite influential. I think that something like anti-power politics has been quite influential for parts of the new left in the 1960s and the 1970s. I think it was quite popular for the anti-globalization or the ultra-globalization or the global justice movements in the 90s. I think that it was quite influential in the Occupy and Squares movements of the 2000s and 2010s. And I think to a certain extent it is influential today, although potentially the pendulum is shifting in the other direction.
And I think I interrupted you earlier when you were talking about kind of the motivation of writing this book. So is the intention of this book to somehow pose an alternative to what Holloway is urging the left to do?
I would say it's not merely an alternative to what Holloway is arguing for, because I think that many who argue for anti-power politics offer some good criticisms of those on the radical left, including social democrats, socialists, and certain parts of the communist tradition. They offer good criticisms of their attempts to change the world by taking state power. And so what I think the authors in this book attempt to do is reconcile the best aspects of both of these traditions, the tradition that is wary of co-optation by the state, and the tradition that thinks, nonetheless, we have to engage with the state, we have to act through the state in certain ways, even if that is not the entirety of our strategy.
What has the left, or large parts of it, concluded about the wisdom of developing, of coming up with a single, encompassing, long-term strategy for achieving its goals of a more just world?
Well, I think that often the attempt to create a all-encompassing, long-term strategy is open to genuine criticism. I think that often political parties of the left, whether they be social democratic, socialist, or communist, have often attempted to create this collective strategy, this long-term strategy, in highly reductionist ways. Reductionist in the sense that they neglect the diversity within the working class and what it would mean to create genuine solidarity between different groups of the working class, including the inequalities within the working class. It's often been reductionist in the ways in which it has neglected some of the other inequalities and oppressions that are just as integral to capitalism as is the class inequality between workers and capitalists. By this I mean ableism, ageism, racialization, patriarchy, colonialism, imperialism, sexism, heteronormativity, and the like. And so I think that there are excellent criticisms made of attempts to do this. On the other hand, I think that we should be aspiring less to a kind of fragmentation of our politics along different categories of difference. We should be aspiring to a politics that is rooted in universal principles. Something that does not want to achieve unity by imposing uniformity, something that is not merely the party line of a rather undemocratic leftist party, but nevertheless something that has universal principles based on a fundamental equality of human beings.
Well, on this issue of kind of a long-term strategy, I mean, a lot of people associate that with communist parties in the past, socialist parties, social democratic parties operating in various nations. How would you assess the state and status of, for example, communist parties in the world today?
Well, I think the communist parties of the world today have a varied experience. Many of them have gone into decline or have disbanded altogether. Some of them have remained largely the same, engaging in orthodox Marxism of the old type, but have become quite marginal forces within their own societies. And then some of them are quite prominent, but communist in name only. And by this I mean, for example, the Chinese Communist Party, which for decades now has been making its own kind of authoritarian status transition to capitalism.
And what about social democratic parties? How intent are they on moving their respective societies towards socialism?
Well, in the early to mid-20th century, the goal of many social democratic parties was to achieve a kind of socialist society, a society beyond capitalism, but to do so largely through parliamentary reforms. They would get elected, and they would attempt to gradually create socialism within capitalism. However, they encountered a number of barriers along the way, and we can talk about that in more detail later on if you would like. And generally, towards the mid and the end of the 20th century, the Social Democratic parties largely abandon any attempt to fundamentally transform capitalist society. The goal ultimately was to create the best kind of capitalism possible, capitalism with a human face, as it was often referred to. The problem has been that social democratic parties, particularly in the new millennium, have essentially become the left wing of the neoliberal consensus. So it's not that they reject austerity policies that seek to cut the amount of money going to public services. It's not that they reject the privatization of many of these public services, the attempt to take public goods out of the public sector and to put them into the market. They haven't rejected this. They've only tried to ameliorate it. And I think we are seeing a decline of social democratic parties, especially among those that were the most influential within their own countries. And a part of this is a broader disenchantment with the mainstream establishment political parties, of which the social democratic parties are a part.
Paul Christopher Gray joins me. He teaches political science and labor studies at Brock University in St. Catharines, Ontario, Canada. He's editor of the new book, From the Streets to the State, Changing the World by Taking Power. It's published by State University of New York Press. So I want to get back to this question of autonomous institutions pushed by people like John Holloway. And again, as you said earlier, examples of these are democratic unions, popular assemblies, cooperatives fit in there, workplace and neighborhood councils. Under what circumstances, and it's useful to look historically at the historical record, and you do this in the first chapter of your book, From the Streets to the State. Looking at it historically, under what circumstances have autonomous institutions actually been able to vie with state institutions for legitimacy and popularity?
Well, I think this is one of the major problems with Holloway's attempt to make a general strategy, this idea of changing the world without taking power. Because the actual historical examples of these autonomous institutions being able to actually rival their national states is quite exceptional. It happens very rarely and only in a few set of circumstances. So it primarily happens after defeat in war. This was the case with the Paris Commune in the 19th century, with the Russian Soviets or the council governments in places like Hungary after the First World War. It also happens after defeat in colonial war, as was the case in Portugal in the 1970s. And it occurs when trying to struggle against the seizure of state power by fascist forces, as was the case in Spain in the 1930s. But this only occurred in places where parliamentary institutions were quite weak. The other examples where it hasn't happened as a result of the things that I've already laid out are places where it's only occurred in a single neighborhood or in a single fairly marginalized region, as is the case, you know, in autonomous institutions being single buildings that have been converted into squats in Berlin, for example, or certain neighborhoods within particular cities, such as Exarchia in Athens, or, as is the case with the Zapatistas and their considerable achievements, limited but considerable, in the southernmost region of Mexico. Now, don't get me wrong, I think that these institutions like democratic unions, workers' councils, neighborhood councils, people's assemblies, and the like are incredibly important. Whether these can actually create alternative institutions to the state, whether these can actually rival national states, the power of national states. That's what I'm more skeptical about.
And are the autonomous institutions you just mentioned, are they to some extent left alone by the state or tolerated by the state because of their limited size and scope?
Yes, I would think so. In the case of those autonomous institutions that have not been harassed or outright repressed by the state, it's usually because the state might not even be aware of their existence, or their existence is quite marginal and does not really reach that many people or call into question governance at any level, including the municipal level. Or in rare circumstances, these autonomous institutions are perceived as a significant threat to the national state, and yet they have been unable to spread beyond the region in which they have existed for some time, and that includes the Zapatistas.
How big is the threat of state repression of autonomous institutions when they achieve a kind of significance and meaningful scale in terms of, you know, the area in which they operate?
Well, I think it's basically inevitable. If these autonomous institutions reach a certain size and a certain number of people, such that they do start to threaten the sovereignty of the national government institutions, that they will face various forms of harassment or repression. Harassment could include things like if these institutions are providing some needed services, say health services to local neighborhood, they could be harassed over questions of licensing and whether they're adhering to the existing laws. But beyond that, I think all of these institutions at a certain point are subject to outright state repression. That's not to say that political parties that are engaging in electoral politics and attempting to transform the state by also operating within government aren't also subject to state repression in a variety of ways. Nevertheless, if you already have political power within government institutions, you can start to create allies and bastions of strength that might be able to mitigate some of this repression or win enough of an alliance between forces within the state and your allies beyond it to prevent it from occurring, at least in its most direct and repressive ways.
What about alliances with state workers? Is it important for autonomous institutions to form alliances? And I'm thinking about workers, and you were thinking about workers when you wrote this book, that provide public services?
Well, I think that this is a significant question. If an anti-power politics is trying to create alternative institutions that are entirely outside of government, outside of the state, that includes outside of the public sector. And I think that anti-power politics will confront a variety of challenges in its attempts to pull allegiance away from government institutions toward their own alternative, including from public sector workers whose livelihoods, their jobs, and the services that they provide to people who are in need will be negatively affected by this. And so anti-power politics is open to the prospect of immense sabotage by public sector workers, by state workers. More importantly, however, I think that those who are attempting to transform the world for the better can have a significant ally in these public sector workers. They can be allies on the inside of the state, so to speak. They will certainly be against the decomposition of government, but they might not be against the democratization of government. And in this, I've been influenced by the work of Carmen Siriani in particular. There are numerous examples of public sector workers being excellent allies for members of civil society who are outside of government institutions. So to take one example, this is the case study that's explored by Greg McElliott in the book. In the 1980s, Toronto immigration officers decided that they wanted to change how they went about their struggles to improve their working conditions. Now, immigration officers might not be the first group you think of for having progressive politics, but many of these workers, these public sector workers, decided that instead of following the normal channels of collective bargaining with the government, they were going to try to form alliances with immigrants and immigrants' rights groups with whom they, up until this point, had often had quite an antagonistic relationship. And so they decided to create coalitions in which members of the Immigration Officers Union, as well as members of these immigrants' rights groups, could participate as equal partners, talk about their mutual experiences, their mutual ideas, and try to overcome some of the divisions that had existed between them. And most importantly, try to come up with a collective strategy. And essentially, what they came up with was a work-to-rule campaign. The immigration officers decided that they were only going to see as many new applicants for immigration status as could reasonably be seen within a normal working day. Now, this meant that there were many applicants to immigration status who would not be seen over the course of that day. And had there been no prior work through this coalition, then this probably would have upset these immigrants' rights groups and immigration applicants greatly. But the point is that it put a lot of pressure on the government, especially when these immigrants' rights groups, applicants to new immigrant status, as well as social movements groups, joined the makeshift picket lines that had been formed around this Work to Rule campaign by the immigration officers. And it got national coverage in Canada and proved to provide so much pressure that the government was forced to hire 280 new immigration officers so that they could actually have enough people to do the job well, to actually consider the applications for immigration status for new immigrants to Canada. I think that this is an excellent example of the way in which public sector workers can be allies, and I think potentially it could be extended. Why not go beyond temporary coalitions? Why not begin to construct councils, permanent organizations where public sector workers in various fields reach out to the user groups who depend on the services that they provide and get both to participate in councils where they can discuss how the services should be provided, what kind of resources would be necessary to provide them in the right way, and to come up with collective strategies that can put pressure on the existing political parties to expand and to improve the public sector and public services.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Paul Christopher Gray joins me. He teaches at Brock University in Ontario, Canada. And his new book is From the Streets to the State, Changing the World by Taking Power. He has edited the book and written a chapter in it. Contributors include people like Leo Panitch and Greg Albo and Hillary Wainwright and many others. To continue kind of with the issue of autonomous institutions and what they can and cannot do within society, right, apart from the state, not engaging with the state, what should be said about their ability to raise the money and resources needed to carry out their functions, especially if they grow beyond the local scale?
Well, this, I think, is a major shortcoming of strategies to try to build these autonomous institutions beyond local scales. Because as soon as you attempt to do so, you are going to run into problems of how are you going to raise enough money, enough revenues, to be able to provide the kinds of services that people need in our society. And so I think that the attempt to create these autonomous institutions beyond the local level will always face a fiscal crisis. And I'm skeptical about the idea of attempting to organize a mass tax strike or tax withdrawal and then putting the funds towards these alternatives to the already existing government institutions, not only because this would be extremely difficult to organize and would face all sorts of repression from government, but also it could have potentially chaotic effects that would have the most immediate and dire impacts on the people who depend on the public services that are paid for by these taxes.
Now, you counterpose the anti-power politics group with kind of the tendency that wants to engage and does engage with the state. You call this parliamentarism. And you write that for this tendency, the state is democratic. It embodies universal liberties, not the power of the capitalist class and elite groups. So this tendency argues that the radical left can use the state to fully realize its liberties in ways that preserve the continuity between the partial democracy permitted under capitalism and the full democracy allowed by socialism. I guess my question is, to what degree do you think the state in a capitalist society can be considered to be kind of separate from the capitalist class, can be considered to be, to have some kind of independence from what the capitalist class wants and desires?
Well, I think one of the essays in the book that tackles this question quite well is written by Thomas Chiasson-Labelle. And before his analysis of the pink tide governments in Latin America, and in particular in Venezuela and Ecuador, he asked the question, to what extent is the state autonomous from the ruling classes, the elite groups, from the capitalist class in the capitalist societies? And he goes through some of the debates. He disagrees with liberals, for example, who believe that the state is more or less autonomous from all of the groups in society, or insofar as it is influenced by one or another of these groups, it's because they've happened to mobilize the resources, the constituencies, and the networks necessary to wield this influence. But he also disagrees with the Leninist conception of the state as a mere instrument or tool of the ruling class, something that adheres to what the capitalist class wants to do. So he's touching on this idea that there is a relative autonomy of the state. That is, that, yes, the most influential group within capitalist society tends to be the capitalist class, is the capitalist class. They have immense influence on state policy. But that does not mean that there aren't disagreements between them for a variety of reasons. First, capitalist class is not a homogeneous group. There are many different factions of the capitalist class. They are in competition with each other. They often have different political ideas about what society should be and how to achieve it. And they're not always in a seamless relationship with the state. The state is not a black box. It is not a homogeneous entity. It is also the site of different contending groups with their own ideas, their own policy networks or institutional affiliations or allegiances and the like. And there's nothing guaranteeing that the dominant factions of the capitalist class and the dominant factions of the political elites within governance have come up with the right strategies to actually impose their will on society. They can do things that open up space for a contestation, for resistance by forces who are not in the capitalist class, who are not in the ruling groups, the elite institutions, and the like. So I think we have to have a much more complex conception of the relationship between ruling classes and the state, in particular, just how dynamic and heterogeneous are the groups and institutions within it.
His name is Paul Christopher Gray. He teaches political science and labor studies at Brock University. We'll take a short break and speak more with Paul. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Paul Christopher Gray has a new book out. He's editor of From the Streets to the State, Changing the World by Taking Power. It's published by State University of New York Press. Paul teaches at Brock University in St. Catharines, Ontario. So even given the heterogeneity of the society and the various factors and forces within it, you do stress in your introduction or in the chapter one of this book, Paul, which is kind of your critical introduction, you do stress the bias that nations that exist under capitalism have toward the capitalist class. And you point to what happens to the ability of, for example, socialist governments. So let's say a socialist party gets into power. The ability of socialist governments to fundamentally transform capitalist states in the face of what often turns into a hostile capitalist class. So what are the threats or what actions can be and are taken by capitalists that may make it very problematic for a socialist government to carry out what it wants to do?
Well, I think one of the very real and significant criticisms that proponents of the anti-power politics group make about those attempts that so far have tried to change the world by taking power, one of the major criticisms they make is these attempts fall into what is called the social democratic trap. So often, socialist or certain variations of communist parties have been elected in periods of social and economic crisis when people are looking for genuine alternatives. And these socialists and communist parties have a radical agenda, things that they would like to achieve. And it occurred time and time again that they would begin to introduce these reforms and then, when the moment of rupture with the existing system, with capitalism, arose, they stepped back. They did not move from reform to revolution. And ultimately, what they accomplish is saving capitalism from itself during periods of crisis and doing a little bit better than what liberal or conservative parties would have accomplished in that period when people were looking for alternatives. So the question becomes, why does the social democratic trap emerge? Why does it happen consistently to attempts to change the world by taking power? I think we should look at the state not as a institution that is neutral between different groups and classes within society. I think we should look at it as having three major biases. And it might help to think of this as a series of trenches. Each bias is a trench that is ever deeper than the one before it. And ultimately, any attempt to change the world by taking power will have to navigate all three of these trenches.
Okay, so three trenches, three levels of bias. One level of bias that you write about is interpersonal. What is interpersonal bias?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of people who are the elites of political parties, who get elected, who are the politicians or the senior civil servants who are forming policy and implementing it, tend to come from elite groups, including the capitalist class. They are influenced by its ideas. They are socialized into its traditions, its customs, its ways of seeing things. as I put it in the introduction, members of the ruling classes, they are groomed. Members of the working class, they are only raised. And so anyone who would attempt to enter government and transform it in any significant way will have to contend with those groups who are not used to seeing policy or politics in anything broader than a largely liberal or conservative framework, and who will outright oppose any of these ideas by these groups.
The other two levels of bias are what you call institutional bias and systemic bias. Tell us about those.
Yeah, so the second bias and the second trench, which is much deeper than the first, is institutional bias. And that essentially means that it takes a lot of resources to get elected, to actually win election campaigns. And it takes a lot of resources and institutional connections to have influence, to make connections with those people who have been elected. And since ruling groups, members of the capitalist class, tend to have these resources and these institutional connections more than anybody else, they'll have more influence, and therefore government policy will be biased towards them. But these first two trenches, these first two forms of bias, do not come anywhere close to the obstacle that's created by the third trench, the systemic bias that exists in governments today. We should recall that in order to implement policies, governments are dependent on tax revenues. This is how they finance their policies. So typically, what has happened is in periods where socialists or communist parties have been elected, there's been an alliance within the working class and with other oppressed groups who vote these parties into power. Then these parties begin to implement the reforms that they've promised in their platform. Maybe they're going to increase wages. They're going to offer affirmative action policies. They're going to improve environmental standards. Maybe they're going to go so far as to nationalize certain industries or banking institutions. And at a certain point, what happens is the capitalist class, employers, shareholders, investors, decide that the current economic environment is not favorable toward profitability or their political interests. And because they own these companies as their own private property, they can decide what they do. So they stop investing resources into these companies, into the economy. So this creates downturns, and it can lead to economic crises. This also leads to a reduction in tax revenues, which, recall, is the basis by which any government in a capitalist society is going to implement its reforms, implement its policies. And so the combination of economic crises and the lack of implementation of government reforms tends to hit worst those constituencies who have voted for the socialist or communist parties that are currently in power. And given that they are hurt the most by these downturns, by these crises, then they tend to vote their parties out of power, hoping that there will be some amelioration of the effects of the downturn, the lack of investment in the economy. So one of the most significant points about this third bias, this third and deepest trench, is that even if political parties that are not members of the ruling class, the ruling elites, win government power, that does not mean that there aren't other ways of influencing government decisions outside of the government itself. And this is primarily a form of economic influence that ruling elites, the wealthy, the capitalist class, can have, even when their own parties are not ruling these governments. And typically, the third trench has always been the source of the social democratic trap. And any attempt to go beyond it, any attempt to genuinely transform society, will have to figure out how to navigate this third trench.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, that suggests that socialist and communist parties who are trying to gain power, trying to take power in a country, face a perhaps insurmountable obstacle if and when capitalists respond to their policies, their reforms, their proposed reforms with capital strikes, investment strikes, and capital flight. So what are you saying about what socialist parties who do vie for state power must do either before or after taking power to somehow counter this threat, to somehow react or respond to this threat, or maybe even head off the threat before it materializes?
Well, this is one of the major reasons why I am not entirely critical of either anti-power politics or those attempts to change the world by taking state power. This is why I think we have to try to reconcile the best aspects of those two traditions. Because what it means is that there are a variety of sources of power within society, not just in the state and not just beyond it. And so any attempt to fundamentally transform society, to democratize it, to make it more equal, will have to operate at these different sources of power simultaneously and have to be doing things in a more cooperative and cohesive strategy so that they can play off the strengths of each other. This is one of the reasons why I argued that a collective strategy, a long-term strategy, is so important. So any political party or political parties that would attempt to take office and transform society has to anticipate from the outset that they are going to provoke these kinds of confrontations with the capitalist class and with ruling elites. And if they want to go beyond a reformist agenda, if they're going to try to surmount this third trench, then they're going to have to develop the kind of politics that must already have been in place and developed to a significant degree before taking office is really a feasible project. If a political party that has taken office is implementing reforms, and suddenly a group of capitalist class, say in a major industry, decides to engage in a capital strike, they decide to withhold their investment, then the question arises, are we going to try to extend democracy beyond just the narrow confines of the realm of politics, beyond the narrow confines of parliamentary institutions? Is there the question of bringing these major industries into not only national control, but democratic control? Because if this government, in an attempt to prevent the worst aspects of this capital strike, simply nationalizes this industry, if they simply seize property ownership over this industry, that doesn't necessarily entail that it's any more democratic. It could be structured along the same lines that exist now, except instead of private employers, you have state employers, but still all the same hierarchies that exist. If you want to not only nationalize that industry, but to democratize it, there might already have to have been a series of reforms within that industry, namely around questions of workers' control. What is workers' control? Well, essentially, it's the idea that workers should not only struggle for things like higher wages, benefits, better hours, and the like, but for more participation in the major decisions of the companies for whom they work. And if they start prioritizing these kinds of demands in their collective bargaining or in their struggles with these companies, they begin to develop their own democratic capacities necessary to understand how the company or the corporation as an institution works, its connection to the economy. And so any political party that would attempt to not only take office, but to take power, to be able to surmount this third trench, the classic source of the social democratic trap, would probably have to be paralleled by broader attempts within the working class to not only fight for better wages, for more benefits and the like, but for workers' control, to have developed the capacities necessary to actually be able to run these industries if they are not only nationalized, but democratized.
And nationalization also means, as you write, challenging the system of private property, of private ownership of productive property.
That's right.
Paul Christopher Gray is his name. He is editor of the new book, From the Streets to the State, Changing the World by Taking Power. It's published by SUNY Press. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, Paul, we've been talking a lot about what you have written in Chapter 1 of this book. It's called From the Streets to the State, A Critical Introduction. And you have been mentioning along the way some of the other contributions to this book. Can you give us a brief synopsis of at least some of the other essays, chapters in this book?
So I provide a critical introduction to some of the more general aspects of these questions. Then in the second chapter, Leo Panitch provides this long, arcing historical survey of the attempts by working class folks and their allies to democratize political parties, to democratize administration, and to democratize governance and the state. Then we move into particular case studies which look at the relations between political parties, social movements, government, and also the attempts to use law or legal mobilization as a way to win some of your demands and to create more leverage. So Davier LaFrance and Caterina Principe write about the new radical left parties in Western Europe. Thomas Chiasson-Labelle evaluates the rise and fall of the pink tide in Latin America. Talia Cuno looks at the relationship between cooperatives, people's assemblies, and the attempt to not only take office but take power by Chokwe Lumumba and the People's Assembly in Jackson, Mississippi. And Michael McCann and George Lavelle look at ways in which social movements can use lawyers and the law in a way that does not allow them to dominate those social movements and to rely too much on litigation strategies. We then shift to the question of democratic administration. Greg Elbow provides a sweeping survey of the major traditions of administration and how democratic administration provides an alternative that is more just. Then Hillary Wainwright looks at a number of case studies by public sector workers and radical left political parties to not only expand the public sector, but to improve services in a way that empowers user groups rather than just passively giving them services. Tammy Finley offers her theory of what she calls femocratic administration. And then finally, Greg McElliott asks a very difficult question. We've talked about democratizing administration in things like the public sector. What would it mean to try to address the hierarchy and lack of democracy within some of the more coercive institutions of the state? And so he asks, what might the relationship be between prison reform and prison abolition and prison guards and cooperatives within prisons? And he uses Italy as a case study.
Paul Christopher Gray. He teaches political science and labor studies at Brock University in Canada, and he is editor of the new book. It's called From the Streets to the State, Changing the World by Taking Power. Paul, thanks for putting together this book and for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a great conversation.
And that interview first aired last September 12th. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. And you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.